building of prison camps by the Federal Emergency Management Agency with no stated purpose. The corporate takeover of food and agriculture, pharmaceuticals and healthcare, even the military in clandestine agendas to fatten, dull, sicken, and control a populace already consumed by consumerism.
And I encourage you all to go shopping more.
A government that taps your phone, collects your data, and monitors your whereabouts with impunity. A government preparing to use that data against you when it strikes. And the final takeover begins.
The takeover of America.
By a well-oiled and well-armed multinational group of elites that will cull, kill, and subjugate.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. So welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 29th of July, 2022. Streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol. And also on the new talkradio.org.uk stream. That's what you're listening to on now if you're listening live. And also at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, which is a sort of a, I suppose, what in the 1950s they'd call a relay station. I'm Tony Gosling, and thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade BBC Ukraine psychological warfare propaganda, and, of course, switching off all the Russian media and things like that, the Iranian media, not in order to stop our minds being bent by the Russians, but to stop their news interfering with our propaganda, so to stop us being able to compare what our London media is saying with what people are saying in the other parts of the world. Is that really the way to go? Of course it's not. Also, of course, COVID medical misinformation, which we'll be looking at specifically this evening, and spending a little while dwelling on some of the information that's been coming to light about injuries due to the vaccines. Various things now transpiring that, of course, we didn't know when we were getting the hard sell back at the beginning of 2021. Anyway, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And also we're joined live in the studio this week with by radical cartoonist, cancelled from the Morning Star, Stella Perrott. So in part one, the zero carbon policy ruled illegal in the High Court. Quite amazing. The government apparently haven't done any due diligence on how to measure when to stop taxing carbon. Also the death this week of the Gaia Hypothesis inventor James Lovelock at 103. Fiercely independent scientist, he discovered apparently a hole in the ozone layer caused by CFCs, type of chemicals used in fridges and other things and in aerosol cans, and it was fixed apparently. He was very pro-nuclear, but he did say that some Greens were overzealous and over the top. Also saying that parts of the world would be unlivable in by 2100, so at the end of this century. Also, we've seen this week the European Union bailing out Germany to sort out their gas shortage. And in part two, as I said, the latest vaccine science and COVID science emerging. And finally, we've had a look at the Antichrist. How about the false prophet, the man the globalist elite call the prophet, Yuval Noah Hariri? In a way, this is a cue from the lovely Dr. Zev Zelenko, who died a few weeks ago, where he is saying, take a look at this guy, he's a bad boy. Where is he leading these elite psychopaths? By the nose. A close look this week at Yuval Noah Hariri. So, Iranian and Russian news cancelled. First, the telecoms cartel did it, and then Ofcom followed along. Cancelled also off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here. Welcome, Stella Perrott, radical cartoonist. Can you just, for those that haven't heard you before, tell us a little bit about how you got cancelled? You're actually a very good artist. You wouldn't be sitting here if you weren't actually very good at doing... I mean, I see a lot of cartoons, I think, well, yeah, they're having a go, but it's not in their blood. It's definitely in your blood.
Well, you've seen my book, haven't you, Tony? Because last time I was here, I handed over a copy of my book for you. Which I'm going to plug. It's called 2020, the year we were all cancelled. So it's all about coronavirus restrictions, heavy-handed policing. I'm sure lots of your audience would like it. Available on Amazon. There you are. That's my plug. I was an editorial cartoonist for the Morning Star for 5 years. In fact, in writing, they referred to me more than once as their star cartoonist. So I can't say fairer than that. They used me kind of all the time. 5 years.
So did they? How did they commission cartoons for you? Did they phone you up and say, we want this, or did you submit stuff?
No, it's literally keeping an eye on what's in the news, what's coming up. you have a rough idea. I mean, obviously, with the Morning Star, you know what their agenda is before you, you know, so you know what angle they're going to cover it from. So it's just literally submitting.
But, so why did they cancel you?
Over one particular cartoon, which was one out of many hundreds, because obviously over 5 years you submit a lot of cartoons, some they use, some they don't. And this one cartoon offended the trans lobby.
Did they use the cartoon in the paper?
Yeah, they printed it. But
so
then,
the editor decided to use it, but then the editor changed his or her mind.
The editor blamed his staff who were there when he was away on holiday, which is a feeble way of ducking out of editorial responsibility.
Oh, that's terrible.
And the TUC held a special counsel to threaten the Morning Star with defunding if they did not print a retraction and drop me as a cartoonist.
How interesting. So really it was the Trades Union Congress that made the decision.
Because there are trans activists embedded in each trade union, and the kerfuffle that blew up on sort of Twitter persuaded
Martin Summers, this is a little bit concerning, isn't it? That, you know, you've got the body that's supposed to be representing the trade unions is acting as a gatekeeper here.
Well, there's always going to be political arguments of various kinds, and trade unions are going to have them as like any other body. What we're really talking about here is the power of the trans lobby within those trade unions to do something like that, which is quite extraordinary if you think about it, and also doesn't reflect well on them, really.
No, it doesn't. And so how have you found things? Have you found another outlet? Have you found other people willing to take your cartoons? Say, should we say maybe the new generation? I mean, I don't think of the Morning Star, but I suppose now you've told me a story, in a way, Morning Star is legacy media, but there is a lot of other media out there.
Yeah. For the most of last year, 2021, I was the regular political cartoonist for a website called uncancelled.co.uk. They were quite brave, but unfortunately they sort of folded through personal illness reasons. This is the problem with the smaller media, especially if they're just run by one person. As soon as that person drops out or something happens to them, that's the end of it. So I've found outlets for my cartoons through various campaigning groups on various websites and on social media such as Getter, which is the up-and-coming one, which is going to take over from Twitter eventually, I think. Basically free speech outlets wherever I can find them.
What's your latest cartoons about, the last couple?
tend to be about defunding the BBC, which is a big subject, you know.
Well, no, I mean, why would you want to defund the BBC? I mean, people don't have to pay a licence fee, do they? They're moving towards decriminalising that.
Yeah.
And, I mean, surely the BBC do occasionally some good stuff. I mean, they're under attack, aren't they, by the Tories?
I think it's to do with their legacy of covering up certain people.
Jimmy Savile?
Yeah, what words are we allowed to use on this radio station? Yeah, it's that sort of legacy that I would much prefer to see them supported by advertising.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, one of the reasons I gave you a call and you very kindly agreed to come in today is because we've had a whole load of problems in Bristol, protests going on over something called the Drag Queen Story Hour. Now, last time you were here, we were talking about I can't remember what it was called now, over at the tobacco factory.
The Family Sex Show.
Family Sex Show, that's right, where children were being invited to, which I got the former mayor, George Ferguson, who runs the tobacco factory, to say he thought it was there was no argument at all to say that that sort of thing shouldn't go on. But it certainly seems to be, Bristol almost seems to be one of the main cities in Britain that this stuff is rolling out. So what is the Drag Queen Story Hour?
It's something that the last time this was on tour and came to Bristol was about 5 years ago, and there were some protests at various libraries, but nothing like the vociferous protests we're seeing now. So it's going all around the country. Bristol's just one of the places it's come to.
We've only just got into the summer holidays, and parents are being encouraged to bring their children along, aren't they, to these? I mean, how old are the kids likely to be?
Well, the ones we've seen on various videos are very young, toddler age. I mean, if you take a child to a story reading hour in a library, it is toddlers usually. We're talking about little kids who don't even understand what an adult is saying to them, basically.
And for parents, it's a good place to leave the kids for a couple of hours.
No, parents usually stay with them. Yeah, they stay with them. I mean, I've seen lots of children's story hours going on in libraries, and it's all singing the wheels on the bus, and it's usually quite harmless stuff, you know, which is what it should be.
Okay, so there have been protests. There's also been an arrest.
Yeah, and you told me who's been arrested, so I'm not sure who's arrested.
It was one of the Antifa people was arrested.
Was this yesterday? Yesterday,
yeah. In Fillwood, we hear today that the drag queen story hour has been postponed due to safety concerns. Now, you've got a little leaflet about them there. Do you want to just tell us what you know about these drag queen story hours?
Well, Bristol Libraries put this out on their website about 3 weeks ago, started advertising the dates, so obviously we knew where they were, what time they were and all that. I think what happened in Henley's has been gone so sort of viral on the internet and social media that the police are starting to think, is this actually an efficient use of taxpayers' money and our officers' time to protect drag queens when an ordinary member of the library services could sit and read to children?
A woman arrested by police as protesters clashed outside a number of Bristol libraries where a drag queen was reading stories to parents and children has been released. The woman, who's not been named, was detained by police and put into the back of a police van after common assault alleged against a man was made during a heated scene outside the library in Bristol today. Well, this is, I believe, it's Chris, who's calls himself Tyrant Finder. Who's a bit of a YouTube star, really. Whenever there's anything going on in Bristol, you can follow it generally on his channel. He's also had previous clashes with Antifa, who Antifa groups don't like him filming them. They see him as the enemy, Martin. This is a bit worrying, isn't it, when you've got the anarchists now saying, well, if you're filming anything to do with us, then we see you as part of the enemy, part of the system, and actually get quite aggressive. And in this case, it looks as if that this guy who was filming was actually attacked by the Antifa, who were defending the right of the drag queen story hour to go ahead.
Well, you're going to find these kind of conflicts about lots of different issues, not just about drag queens. You're sometimes going to find that there's quite strong feelings on both sides, and the police inevitably are then drawn into being in the middle of it. I mean, when we were demonstrating to remove the statue of Colston, there was quite a substantial group of people who didn't want us to do that, and they were arguing with the people as it happened. We were arguing with them, and the police basically were having to mediate that. Whatever your views about this, you've clearly got two groups of people who feel quite strongly about it, and the dangers are obvious, aren't they? In any society, these things can get out of control.
Can I put in this in the context of the speaker's corner we had on College Green on the 19th of July, which is only a couple of weeks ago, at which I spoke, and it's all on video, it's all on the internet. And we had a very sort of verbally violent confrontation with a group of around about 100 of these masked sort of men and their followers. And that is the subject of a special police inquiry now, which is going to use police body cam evidence to kind of differentiate if anybody has made allegations about anything. And my MP, Bristol West MP, Thangham Debonair, had a very nice letter from her. We've had very nice letters from the elected Police and Crime Commissioner about this inquiry, and they are... They're obviously going to use it to train their officers how best to police these kind of events, how to keep the two sides apart, which they totally failed to do at College Green. Can I read out my MP's letter?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, not the whole thing.
I'll read a couple of paragraphs. She's been very good, and she's replied to all the people who contacted her. Thanks for emailing me about the events in the centre of Bristol on the 19th of June. It makes for disturbing reading. Many women have written to me about the way a group of masked men were able to harass, intimidate and threaten women in the centre of Bristol, seemingly without police intervention.
Before you carry on, can you just tell us why they were there? What was the actual confrontation about?
Well, with the agreement of police, we were holding a speaker's corner, which we've held in London regularly and other cities as well. And the police should have been prepared in case there was any opposition.
OK, so who is we?
A group called Standing for Women. Which is a national group.
And what's the Standing Women's position that these anarchists find so irritating?
Well, I think they just don't like the fact that we invite anybody, we invite men as well, we invite anybody to come up to the microphone and talk about their own experiences. whether it be in schools or whether it be, you know, anywhere where they've had problems with this kind of issue, we allow them to speak.
Well, which kind of issue?
We're talking about men invading women's safe spaces.
Right. So this is, again, this is to do with the idea of a man identifying himself as a woman and then going into areas which are strictly just reserved for women.
Yes. Changing rooms, prisons, hostels, rape crisis centres, all kinds of spaces, yeah.
Some would say, Martin, that this has kind of gone too far, that the idea, it wasn't really thought through when women are entitled to their own space, and if someone is biologically a woman, it's not okay for a man to just say, well, I'm a woman too, so get out of the way, I'm coming in.
Well, this is, in a sense, a very abstract debate for a minority of people. The majority of people aren't that engaged with it one way or the other.
Oh, I totally disagree. I'm sorry.
Well, let's start to say why she disagrees, Martin.
Because this is a child safeguarding issue which should be of interest to all parents, men and women. This is not.
Why
just
is this about children? You're talking about just about women's about it being a woman's issue.
No, it's women's rights groups that held that particular event, but this is mainly about child safeguarding.
Why about children?
Because it's children in toilets and changing rooms in schools and so on where this is allowed to be going on, and that's why we are so upset about it. Can I just read one paragraph from my MP's letter? I have explained that I find it disturbing that behaviour by aggressive men in public, which clearly constituted abusive behaviour by the police force's own definition of violence against women and girls, appears to have been allowed. I've asked several specific questions and requested that she, that's the chief constable, responds to me in writing as soon as possible. The questions I asked include whether any arrests were made, if not, why not, and if she agreed that the behaviour on footage on social media is behaviour that is covered by the police's own definitions of violence against women. I also asked why I was not contacted proactively and for an explanation of how this will be rectified for any future demonstrations. So that was my MP. She was then offered the chance to sit on this special inquiry. She said she didn't have time for parliamentary reasons, but she would feed her comments into it. So that's taking place over the next few weeks.
OK, but Martin, you still think that most people really don't care about this?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think when people are asked about it, they've got a strong opinion about it.
Well, they do care about it then.
Yes, okay. what's going on here is a kind of internal dispute within the so-called left. And isn't it bizarre that you've got masked men attempting to break up a meeting by women on the grounds that they should be allowed to dress as women, but they're not even dressed as women, and it's not really the issue, and they want to identify as women.
Many of the people at the demonstration I was at were men, and we have quite a lot of gay men coming to our events, and they speak about their spaces also being invaded and how this is impinging on the gay movement that they were involved with back in the days when Stonewall started. They're not very happy about this at all. So it's not just women.
No, well, I think I'm reminded of the line from the Bob Dylan song, When the Ship Comes In, and the language that we used for to get the ship confused will not be understood as it was spoken. What I think has happened is that quite legitimate concerns about personal liberation politics, which have been developing over many decades, have been weaponized by I think it's been deliberately weaponized by the deep state to create fissures within our
movement. I would imagine one of those Antifa people, if you were to be at Speaker's Corner, would probably want to come and punch you on the nose.
Well, yes, and you don't
and say, I'm not part of the deep
we
state.
Know,
I've got a mask on.
Yes,
I'm not
know,
part
yes,
of the
I know,
deep state.
But we know in actual fact that the deep state thinks exactly in these terms. The whole Gladio operation in Italy in the 70s. Far left groups were infiltrated.
It was embedded.
And then tried to make what were legitimate demands sound unreasonable. I mean, it's the idea that can you see where I'm going with this? And everybody then gets into a tizzy about all of this, and it's quite like I totally agree. Safeguarding with children is a big issue, and the idea that anything goes has obviously dissipated over the decades. But underlying all of this is that people are being given a series of spectacles to identify with, where they put themselves on the spectrum on one side or the other, and these are false dichotomies often, and actually a way of keeping people from talking about the real issues.
Well, you could see it. You could see it as a kind of Trojan horse campaign, couldn't you? The idea that this is designed to permeate the left, to sweep up quite a lot of the left until you end up with the left fighting the left. Anyway, Stella.
Can I just say at this point that I am a free speech advocate, so I see the women's rights and child safeguarding issue as a part of the wider attack on free speech, both in real life and online. We've obviously got the online harms bill that's going through Parliament.
True.
We've got the new police crime and sentencing bill that's going through. And these things
it's
are part of the...
Gone through.
These are the wider spectrum of assaults on freedom of speech. In the last 48 hours, we've had two walkbacks by police, Wiltshire and Hampshire, who have both apologised for trying to arrest people because of alleged offences, because they are worried about the new guidance from the College of Policing. We've had two police forces walk back their activities in the last 48 hours, which is absolutely brilliant. And about 2 weeks ago, we had new judges' guidelines that people can't be compelled to use people's pronouns if they are a victim in a case and their assailant wants to be used by certain pronouns. That's no longer going to be allowed in court. So there's a lot of things going on in the wider free speech arena.
It's kind of chugged quietly through, and now there's becoming a bit of a legal, an official establishment backlash really against it. But anyway, look, just get back to what happened yesterday here in Bristol. A number of people from outside Bristol came to protest outside each of the libraries in the tour as a Storytime tour visited three libraries across the city during the day, with another three planned on Friday. And at each protest, they were met by counter-protesters supporting the initiative and the drag queen doing the storytelling inside the libraries. After heated exchanges outside Henley's library from 11 a.m, saw the event cancelled. The next slot for the storytelling was at Hillfields Library, where police again tried to separate protesters. It was at Hillfields that one of the counter-protesters was arrested. Avon Somerset Police confirmed she was later de-arrested after giving her details to officers on the ground, and the incident she was arrested for will now be investigated. The drag queen protesters against the drag queen, the counter-protesters supporting the drag queen and the police then all headed to Stockwood Library, where there were similar scenes again. A statement from Avon and Somerset said they tried to facilitate a peaceful protest and to make sure the event was allowed to take place unhindered. Well, several cancellations of this event, so in some cases it didn't take place unhindered, and one would wonder whether actually any children and parents made it into the library to sit and watch this.
Well, it's what as I said earlier on, the police are going to have to make a decision on whether this is a good use of police time to chase these people across the city and try and, you know, separate demonstrators at this library, that library. So this is like an Infantifa on tour, is how we've described it on social media, you know, and it's just ridiculous. I mean, is that a good use of... What actually happened in Henley's, I believe, is that when the drag queen gave up and went off in the police van to the next library, the story time carried on with an ordinary member of the library staff reading to children. So that begs the question of why do they need a drag queen at all?
Yeah, is there an issue, Martin, do you think, of homosexuals, drag queens or whatever talking to these sort of 5-6-year-old kids?
We don't
reading,
believe that the majority are
stories?
Not homosexual.
Well, I think one of them, certainly one of them involved in this was. I mean, they talked to the paper saying that they came out as homosexual several years ago. But, I mean, is there, you know, what is the issue? Is there an issue with these prepubescent kids being taught by drag queens or homosexuals?
Well, certainly no question. I mean, the point about drag queens is drag queens are just men who dress as women. They're not even trans. They're not even necessarily trans people. They're just people who dress as women. And I went to the pantomime just before Christmas with the kids from our school. All of the kids went, apart from the very young ones, because it was a bit too big a show. And we had Cinderella. And in Cinderella, the ugly sisters were, guess what? Blokes dressed as women.
That is the classical argument of what's wrong with drag queens. And we all grew up going to pantomimes and blah, blah, blah. And we all loved it on the television.
But it's not banned, is it?
People like Les Dawson and Stanley Baxter and Liberace and Benny Hill and all these comedians from the old days all dressed as women. And it was just seen as hilarious, right? So that is the classic argument. But drag in itself is an adult entertainment. The majority carried on in gay clubs. It is very lewd. It is very anti-women. And that is the reason that we oppose it in front of children. There's nothing to stop adults going to see it. absolutely fine, pay to go to an adult club and go and see it. No problems with that at all. It is nothing comparable to the actors who act in plays and on stage. That comes from the days of Shakespeare being performed in the village square on the back of a cart, where women weren't even allowed on the stage in those days, and men had to take the women's parts. And that has come all the way through the Victorian music halls to pantomime today. That is part of a classic British tradition. When you go to see the Ugly Sisters in a pantomime as a child, you're laughing along with your parents because you all know that they're men. You all know that they're not supposed to be women. They're actually ugly men imitating ugly women. It's not anything comparable to drag. So I'm sorry that argument doesn't wash.
Bristol City Council, who own these libraries, had this to say about it all. Drag Queen Story Hour at Bristol Libraries offers children a rich experience in storytelling and an interactive way, as well as understanding of different communities. Lessons like this are how we can create a more inclusive society and educate children about tolerance and difference.
I think when you're talking about this, you do need to do a bit of background research. It may not be happening in the ones in Bristol, and that could be because of the protests outside, but there have been drag queen story hours in this country and other countries caught on film where they've invited children to lie on top of them, where they've worn no underwear. I'm sorry, but there is a lot more behind this than just something harmless.
And Bristol City Council carry on to say, unfortunately, it seems some adults need these lessons too. As well as unacceptable abuse online, some people have decided to go to our library to protest. We have put security in place and requested a police presence. I would imagine, Martin, that the police have been quite careful about how this has been policed. And in fact, this may be why this woman, anarchist woman, was de-arrested quite quickly in order to sort of diffuse the situation and not to build up further tension.
Well, I think that's right, because don't forget that this there is no law against this as things stand. For the reasons you've laid out, you're not happy with it, but there's no law against it.
But there's no law against it. A lot of protests. A lot of protests are about things that there's no law against.
No, I know,
there is a law against going and assaulting someone who's filming.
Well, that's right.
It.
So in other words, the police are then left in a situation where people who are putting this whatever show it is on are not breaking any law. And therefore other people are not happy about it and they're protesting against it. And other people are then coming along to protest against that. Well, the law isn't clear here, is it?
Unless you're
going to ban legally.
If you were to go along to this protest yesterday, no one's saying that that's going to happen, but at the moment anyway. But if you to actually go along, there's a very different two very different crowds, aren't there? The Antifa and the anarchists are all masked up and they want to stay anonymous, etc. Whereas the other protesters, the people who are protesting against this drag queen, they seem to be very much more like traditional protesters. They're open, we've seen for many years of CND, etc. in the past. They're not trying to hide their identity at all.
And our events in London, I'm going to another one on Sunday, we have whole families, we have children, we have dogs, all age groups come, men and women, and we basically sit around in Hyde Park and have a party, So it is, as you say, a very different type of crowd.
Well, the anarchists in the past, as you know, a certain strand within the anarchist movement has always gone to protest wearing masks. And of course,
they loved the lockdowns, didn't they? I'm not trying to make a point here. A lot of the anarchists said, "Well, great lockdown. We're forced to wear masks."
You're widening the debate too
not
much.
Not really. No, I'm just making a point that a lot of the anarchists, lots of the Chinese protesters during the
protests in Hong Kong in Bristol, they were all wearing masks as well because that's part of their culture. Yeah. So there's been a culture of wearing masks on demonstrations. In actual fact, wearing masks on demonstrations in Britain is, in fact, illegal. And at one stage, I've been on demonstrations in Bristol where anarchists have been arrested for wearing masks. And then a scuffle has begun. Now, this is fairly common on the continent as well, where the Black Bloc always wears masks. They smash the place up when other demonstrators don't. There's a kind of culture of tolerance developed around.
Okay, so let's just take this one step further. A lot of the idea of wearing masks for the anarchist, the Antifa faction, is so that they can get violent without necessarily incriminating themselves on film. Yeah.
That is the implication. Now, in the past, before the mask wearing and the lockdown and all the rest of it, they would probably have been told to take the masks off. But because of what's happened now, people are allowed to wear masks, and it's become normal. You still see people wearing masks all around the place, quite young people as well. I mean, you know, if you are a ne'er-do-well young lad and you want to cover your face, you can do it. I mean, people would look at you previously. Now they're not necessarily going to look because it's just a normal thing. So, you know, the police could look at that, saying, well, hang on a minute, you can protest here, but you need to take the masks off. Yeah, so we can identify everybody. Now, of course, the anarchists have got a
in fact, that's why that woman was arrested. They identified her and then they've de-arrested her.
Well, the anarchists have got a kind of... On the one hand, they are there defending supposedly the legal right of the drag queen to read the story, but they also turn up masked, in the implication being that they're going to potentially be violent and fight the police, and they don't believe in the police.
Not just the police. They don't believe in the police anyway.
Now, these, you will find within the libertarian movement, you're going to find a whole spectrum of views there, probably with people on both sides of this argument, I would say.
I have never, ever seen at any of our events that I've been to anybody masked, anybody going there, you know.
No, I mean, the masking people are, they are one faction. There will be others of a libertarian bent. You're a free speech advocate, presumably. But you wouldn't go with wearing a mask.
I'm expecting to be interviewed by a documentary film team on Sunday, and I have no intentions of wearing a mask.
But I mean, I think this is this debate is between different radical factions, if you like. And
in a way, what's happening is a lot of people who are, should we say, ordinary people, are being encouraged by different factions to get fighting.
This is what I was hinting at. Because the vast majority of people don't really have a big investment in this. And when they see something about this, they think, oh yes, those mad people over there doing those mad things. They just think the whole thing is just, you know, it's the sort of thing I don't want to get involved in. And it just discredits the whole idea of having radical ideas about sexuality or whatever. And I think a lot of people in the who want to preserve the right to have a radical sexuality have got to recognise that you're going to be, if you alienate people, you're not necessarily going to get what you want.
Yes, Martin, I think you've made a terrific point there. Our philosophy is that we don't even have men as stewards. We always have women as stewards on our events because most women are, you know, quite small, about my height, about 5 foot something. Our stewards don't carry any kind of... Now, I have seen what the other side, we call them the other side, do tend to turn up with people with legal advisor written on their back, and they're going around with notebooks, making notes with everything they can see. I know that they've borrowed that from Extinction Rebellion. They do the same thing. We don't do anything like that. We just invite people to turn up. And our philosophy is that the worse they look, the better we look. So actually, we're quite happy. I mean, Kelly J. Keene, who runs Standing for Women, repeatedly invites Infantifa and anybody else who opposes her views to turn up to our events. She said, please come, boys, you know, so that we can debate you.
Do you ever have a decent debate?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, good. We do. Sometimes, yeah. I mean, we started off at Speaker's Corner back in 2019, at the actual Speaker's Corner, where... You know, it's now all religious fundamentalists shouting at one another. And because it was so, our group got quite big, and we got to the point where we had to move across into the field, and that's where we do it now, you know, at Reformers Tree. So, and that's every month.
On a similar line, another protest been going on in Bristol this week. Police are investigating criminal damage after people were spotted deflating vehicle tyres in Bristol. Multiple cars were targeted in Redland, and police suspect it could be linked to environmental movement, the tyre extinguishers. Now, there's a bit of picture here of someone with a hoodie and a mask on. It looks like a photograph of somebody and a rucksack on their back deflating somebody's tyre. An eyewitness told Bristol Live that they awoke to a commotion outside their home in Florence Park shortly after midnight on Wednesday, the 20th of July, after at least four cars were reported to have had tyres let down. The source initially believed two people had been arrested at the scene, although police were unable to confirm this. Officers at Avon and Somerset said they have a plan in place to support the investigation, which they're categorising as criminal damage. Letting someone's tyres down without permission is not specifically listed as an offence in law, but it can come under other umbrella terms such as criminal damage. So this is apparently an organisation linked to Just Stop Oil, Martin. The idea is let's just go around letting people's tyres down, and then, of course, they can't pollute the environment with their car.
Well, I think the people who would be most worried about this would be Bristol's Green councillors. I mean, they don't really need this kind of thing if they're going to win the next election in Bristol. And, of course, in the wider movement...
But this is direct action, isn't it? It's stopping pollution.
There's direct action and there's direct action. Proper direct action is directed towards, for example, an oil company's rig. Yeah, it's not directed at an ordinary person's car. And of course, anybody can just say that I want direct action, and I could, you know, I don't, you know, it could just turn into personal vendetta, couldn't it? I think the problem we've got is that partly young people often get the wrong end of the stick about all sorts of things because they, you know, they haven't got the political experience to know what's going to work
what's
and what
the
isn't.
Implication of
and the implications of what they're doing. And the other thing is there's deliberate encouragement of chaos by the security services. It's been going on for years, and it's only in very extreme situations, as you got in Northern Ireland, where in actual fact there's you know, people are very, very serious about how they run demonstrations in Northern Ireland. It's, you know, because it can easily turn to violence where people get killed, and that's why they have their kind of demonstrations they have, which are literally military style demonstrations.
Stella, are you tempted to join the tyre extinguishers and let some tyres down to stop pollution?
Well, at the risk of alienating your audience, I'm afraid that's not my politics at all. I don't have a car. I do, you know, I haven't had a car for many, many years now. I rely on public transport. I'm a very big advocate for public transport.
But you can happily support this group then. If you don't have a car, then you don't have anything to lose,
well,
do you?
Why is vandalising somebody's private property acceptable? I agree with Martin. If you want to do that sort of thing, I suppose gluing yourself to the motorway is more more acceptable because it's not against an individual. But, you know, we've got a new police crime and sentencing bill which is going to cover some of this stuff, haven't we?
And it should, I mean, I don't approve of the new bill, but if you do things like this, you're playing into the hands of the people who want these kind of, that's occasionally you may want to do something like that. Yeah. I mean, when we toppled the Colston statue, or not me personally, but I was standing nearby, ultimately that went to court and the jury did not convict. Now, if these people are caught and sent to the court, they will, if they try to go for a jury trial, they will be convicted because it's not the same.
There's no public sympathy really for this sort of activity. I mean, if they wanted to stop this, I mean, personally, this whole business of Just Stop Oil, stopping motorways and whatever it is they do, I mean, if they want to go to an AGM and disrupt and close down an AGM of Shell or those are the people surely that they need to be targeting, aren't they? The individuals who are making the decisions rather than the consumers who are left with no choice.
What it comes across as is that ordinary people are your enemy for doing the normal things they have to do. I mean, people, I have to drive to work in a car because if I didn't have a car, I wouldn't be able to get there on time because of public transport. And because I'm a contract worker, I get moved around.
I mean, you could see this as a sort of cowardice, couldn't you? Well, these people are. This is an easy thing to do in the middle of the night. No one's going to find you. No one's going to detect you. It's actually quite annoying and difficult and more expensive to get organised enough to go to an AGM.
Well, it is. It's a symbolic politics of symbolic protest, but it's not even thought through.
Well, I think also, you know, that to a certain extent, groups like this may think, well, the AGM is just the fascist system. Let's ignore them and let's do something at grassroots.
Yes, and of course, if they were doing something to a commercial operation which didn't affect individuals, there's no thought there. You know, it's just the idea that we can somehow, just by being, you know, and of course, what you've got the Green Party, which is, you know, becoming a respectable political force.
Well, it's potentially going to take over this city, by the way.
Attempting to win power in Parliament and all the rest of it, favour of PR and all the rest of it. Then you've got Extinction Rebellion, who are more involved in trying to carry out direct action. Greenpeace, of course, carried out many direct actions over this, but very carefully thought out, not just at any old target. And then you've got more and more radical groups where they just think, oh, well, this is a chance for us to just go and have a go. Why don't we? You can imagine people sitting in the pub saying, hey, why don't we go up to Clifton and let down some tyres in posh people's cars? It's like schoolboy pranks. But it's not really
it does
politics.
Seem to be. I mean, I'm not saying this fire tyre extinguisher people. Quite a lot of this sort of activity on the periphery of Extinction Rebellion, isn't there? Because they know if they use the Extinction Rebellion label, that's going to blacken the name of Extinction Rebellion. And XR have made it quite explicit that they, if people are going to do something which may be in the furthering the aims of Extinction Rebellion, that if they're going to do something which is not approved of, then you're just going to have to find another name for it.
Very interesting that you've said that, actually, Tony, because we've had the example in Bristol of a group using the XR logo in their social media biops who have joined in with these trans protests against women, having a meeting at Bristol University a couple of months ago. And XR had to distance themselves from that group and say these people are not part of XR. So, yes, there are people using trying to link themselves to XR who are doing quite dubious things.
Well, I mean, we saw that, I mean, in Italy in the late 70s, there was a whole, what they called the movimento, the movement. There was lots and lots of different groups. The Autonomy Operaia, Workers' Autonomy, Autonomy Creativo, who were more sort of, you know, they so dress amongst, up as clowns.
In amongst that movement might be groups which aren't actually working.
Exactly. So it was a very wide movement with lots of different groups, Nuclei, Marti Proletari, Prima Linea. There was all sorts of groups.
The bigger it gets, the easier it is to infiltrate, isn't it?
That's right. And of course, it's infiltrated and manipulated. It's always what...
And discredited.
Cui bono, who benefits?
Yeah, this is what happens, is you get the headlines for the people that have come in to discredit the movement. And it may just be people who have got other tactics. Like, for example, you get a peaceful demonstration. Towards the end of it, there's a faction that pops up and starts attacking the police. And then, of course, that's the thing that hits the headlines.
Yeah, I mean, there are genuine differences about what are the best tactics. But there's also manipulation. And people should be really aware of that. We've got the spy cops inquiry, which has been suspended at the moment. But people should think, we've only seen the tip of the iceberg there.
That's right.
Just imagine how deeply infiltrated the movement is. And that doesn't mean that we should all be paranoid about that. We should just be sensible about it.
Can I say, just for your audience, when I say it's not my politics, I don't mean that the green agenda as such is not my politics. I'm like everybody else. I think we should get rid of all the pollution, rewilding I'm very keen on. So there's lots of the green agenda I am keen on. It's just I'm not in favour of things that disrupt ordinary people, working people's lives, because, like you say, puts the rest of the movement in a bad light.
Counterproductive.
Yeah.
Anyway, interesting, isn't it, that these things happen here in Bristol in the middle of the night. The hissing sound of a tyre going down at 1 or 2 in the morning. Anyway, apparently the police are putting on extra patrols, so allegedly. Anyway, NHS is to close the Tavistock Child Gender Identity Clinic over safety fears. A controversial centre which helped youngsters become transgender is being shut down by the National Health Service after it was deemed unsafe for children. Great. So they've had hundreds, if not thousands, of children go through there, but it's not safe for them. Kira Bell, who was prescribed puberty blockers at the centre when she was just 16 years old, but later stopped the transition process, welcomed the decision. She's now 25. She said, "I'm over the moon. It means many children will be saved from going down the path I went down. It's been a long time coming." She said, "I thought that was the way I needed to go, transition. But really, I just needed some support, mental health support, with some therapy, really." Stella?
Yes. Well, obviously, I've been following this for 2 or 3 years. So, Kira Bell, I remember that case very well. The Tavistock, if you do a bit of Googling, it takes you 5 minutes to find the history of the Tavistock Institute. It goes right back to World War II, eugenicists and Nazis all the way down the line. I hope I can say that word on your radio station. So we're very pleased that the Tavistock Clinic is being closed. We're very pleased that the kids on their waiting list are going to be reallocated to actual National Health Service Trust areas that are going to have new gender clinics. There's going to be one in Manchester and one in London initially by spring next year, and then maybe up to about 3 in other parts of the country later on. The good thing from women's rights point of view, child safeguarding point of view, is that gives another year for the kids who are on the waiting list now to grow up a bit, for their parents to maybe look at both sides of the arguments, think, is my child actually autistic? Do they actually need to be turned into something resembling the opposite sex? It gives everybody another year to maybe think about this kind of thing more sensibly, how they want to deal with their children's misery, their children's depression.
Is it true, though, that 7 or 8-year-olds might have discussions amongst each other or with their parents saying, well, although I'm a girl, I want to be a man when I grow up?
Well, you obviously haven't gone down the rabbit hole of the internet on this subject, Tony, and I don't blame you for not doing so, but we are talking about parents motivated to start this at the age of 2 or 3, never mind when they're old enough to have arguments about it. but very, very young children are being pushed into onto this pathway. Now, the great thing that the government has said about the closure of the Tavistock is that the new clinics will deal with their patients in a holistic manner, which includes very strong links to mental health services. That's what we've always wanted. A very high percentage of these children, boys and girls, but especially girls, have got prior mental health needs. They've been anorexic, they've been autistic, they've been cutting themselves, they are victims of abuse or dysfunctional families. There is no question about this at all, and there's plenty of stories out there to say that they, you know, this is a reaction against puberty, a very strong reaction, but if they're allowed to grow through puberty with help and care and the proper psychiatric support, they can become functioning adults without these problems.
Some of those parents might say, well, it's better to use these puberty blockers so that they can then, when they come to the age of 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, they can themselves decide which direction they want to go in.
But puberty blockers don't work like that. They sterilise you. They actually cause, for girls, they cause a menopause in teenage years. They start losing the bones, you know, they start becoming brittle bones like old women. I'm sorry, this is not reversible. Whatever people may say it is, it's not.
Okay, before we hear from Martin on the closure of the Tavistock, we're going to hear from someone who was a patient there, Richie Heron, who was discussing the closure of the Tavistock Clinic on GB News this week.
I actually told them basically everything that was going on, and despite that, I still went through. So to me, it seemed kind of redundant to go through all that, to tell them absolutely everything, to go through this intense process of therapy, and I didn't get caught by the safeguards. And I'm not alone in this, and that's one of the reasons why the Tavistock is closing down. And also, I would imagine that this will be extended to the other gender clinics. But an important point to note is I feel the move towards the regional centres was something that was going to happen anyway, because they have quite a lot of people to deal with. Now, what we don't want is we don't want this to just open the doors to anyone. We want to make sure that all the safeguards get put in appropriately, not just for children, but for adults too. And the thing was, is as I was going through the lead up to that process, I had a lot of red flags that weren't addressed. And even taking that to the side, the conversation about the longevity and the procedure itself, how it works, what does it look like when the results are good? What do the results look like when they're bad? None of that happened, and it should have. Now, I'm sure other people who go through this process may have a better level of care, but to me and other people who have had a lot of these similar issues, it doesn't seem to be the standard. It seems to be potluck. And yeah, something like this should not be potluck.
Well, no, certainly not. The idea is you're supposed to be going to see professionals. What Richie Heron is suggesting there, Stella, is that, look, you know, they were supposed to be a whole process, a sort of psychological process that the clinic took people through to decide whether it was appropriate to start using these puberty blockers, and to whether that they as children were going to actually engage in a change of their gender. And yet, although he was flagging up all these sorts of signs which said, actually, this is really a mental health problem, the clinic just ignored them and put him through the therapy anyway.
Certainly, and that's why we've had so many whistleblowers from the Tavistock, going back 2 or 3 years, Marcus and Sue Evans, David Bell, other psychotherapists and people who work there have also dropped out, who are not so well known, Sonia Appleby, and they've actually won discrimination cases against the Tavistock. And they dropped out of doing the job that it was their... they were dedicated to, this was their vocation, to work in mental health, because they thought the Tavistock wasn't doing it properly. So what that guy has just highlighted vindicates them, definitely vindicates the whistleblowers. I'll try not to take up your time, but I feel very strongly about this, especially since I was cancelled for a cartoon which highlighted this issue. Mm. Which the Morning Star knew that my reason for even doing the cartoon was because I'd had this as a teenager myself. Now, I grew up in the 70s, long before the internet, long before mobile phones, no social media influences, nothing like that. Never heard about this issue at all. Parents wouldn't have known anything about it. I think there was one support group for transsexual men that existed called the Beaufort Trust, I think, in London. And that was about it. I don't think any doctors had ever even heard of gender dysphoria when I was growing up. So I actually, yeah, I believed all through my childhood that I was a boy. I wanted to go on the pill to stop having periods. I asked my mother why I couldn't have a hysterectomy at the age of 15. I believed that I would grow up to become a man and join the army and grow a beard. And I really believed all this stuff. And yet nobody had talked to me about it. There was no internet. There was no nobody in my peer group or at school who had done anything to make me decide this. And it was only when I hit puberty and started going through puberty, and then you are then forced to realise that your fantasy that is not real, you know, that you're growing up to be a girl. And, yeah, very, very difficult. And I had a very difficult childhood, which led to alcoholism and all kinds of things. And in my case, it was very definitely a post-traumatic stress reaction to a dysfunctional childhood. I am not saying that that's the same for all children, but I am saying that what's happened with the Tavistock, we're very much hoping that it will lead to much more mental health support for these children.
Well, I mean, it's interesting the way you put that, because it's quite clear, Martin, that many of the kids who are sent to Tavistock have had real big difficulties in their early childhood, like Stella's just been talking about there. So that's not something which is going away, is it? Particularly with the cost of living crisis, we've got something like another 2-3 million kids in the next year or so being pushed into poverty.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, obviously, lots of kids have a difficult time.
But more, what I'm saying is, this is on the increase.
Oh, yes, because
things are getting tougher.
As society becomes more brutal, then, of course, that's going to be the case. But I cannot see that there should be such a big deal about what gender you are, especially when you're a child. Children are children. They're inevitably going to have different ideas, but they shouldn't be stereotyped about that. You know, they should just be allowed to play and play with others of their own age and look at the older brothers and sisters and society at large. And, you know, what happens is, I work with children, is they generally pick up what you'd expect them to pick up. The girls really do want to play with dolls mainly. Not all of them. In fact, there's a very strong, there always has been a very strong tendency for some girls to, because they don't like, they find girls' stuff boring. It's not surprising, is it? I mean, look at the women's football team. It's going to be in the Euro final on Sunday. I'll bet you they didn't just spend all their time playing with dolls, did they?
You asked there, that is the voice of reason. And I think that's what the majority of the general public would say if you asked them about this question.
Yes, I mean, I think there's something quite sinister, especially with very young children. Why is it such a big deal? Some people are going to be bisexual. Gosh, so what? But they're not going to know until they're older, are they?
One of the theories is that there is a lot of parents out there who've got Munchausen's by proxy. Now, back in the day, this was all about making your child swallow salt so that they would be took to a hospital and have loads of unnecessary treatment for you to get the vicarious thrill that you wanted.
Yeah.
This has in many ways replaced it. That's one of the theories. Okay.
Well, it could and well this be that more, the parents are pushing it.
Yeah, and this is much more validating for the parents because they might get a TV show out of it. They'll be all over social media. So it's much more exciting and fun than shoveling salt down your kid's throat. And that is one of the actual theories about why some parents push this on their
lots
children.
Lots of kids do need mental health support, but just to say, oh, the problem is that they're not male or they're not female, that's just trivial, isn't it?
No, and I tell you what, that's one of the things I'm very hopeful, that as this juggernaut, if you like, which has taken over our institutions, is slowly being turned around, that one of the good things that's going to come out of it, out the other end, is that we will all be much more accepting about gender non-conforming people. I've gone through my whole life. I'm a 5'1" woman. I'm obviously a 5'1" elderly woman now, but I've gone through my whole life of people shouting me at the street, oh, are you a man or a woman? You get this abuse all the time just because you're gender non-conforming. And I want to see a world where nobody does that to anybody. So if what comes out of all this is more tolerance,
yeah,
then I'll be very, very happy.
Well, hopefully you're not getting that sort of call on the streets of Bristol too much.
I'm too obviously a little decrepit old lady now.
And I mean, you know, maybe you see all sorts of peculiar characters walking down the streets these days. And so it is becoming slowly but surely more normalised, you're quite right.
But nobody who is gender non-conforming goes around insisting that everybody else kind of believes some fantasy they've got. Do you know what I mean? You just want to live your life.
Mm. Well, it's strange when you know you're becoming what is something that's in your mind suddenly moving into becoming a biological change, which hasn't actually really happened, and you know you're not really facing up to that. It's definitely you can see it as something, particularly for children, but also of course for adults too, something which is naturally the mental health people. The people to go to. But what about the idea of just going in the olden days, you know, people would just go and talk to their priest about something like this?
Well, and then they probably, and they may have got some sense or they may not.
Well, they do. Well, Martin priests are generally quite sensible about things like this.
They are. It depends which priest you're talking about, Tony, doesn't it? They always were.
The same with psychiatrists, actually.
Yes, indeed.
One of the other types of people that children would have gone to for help and advice back in the day would be the school matron. And we don't have anybody like that in schools now.
Well, they have police in schools, don't they? So you can talk to the cops about it. Anyway, look, there's another protest going on the beginning of next week. It actually is next weekend. Much more sort of normal type, should we say, which is the Hiroshima and Nagasaki peace gathering. Organised by a Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament here in Bristol. The 76th anniversary of the atomic bombs dropped on Japan in 1945, which led to the deaths of 280,000 people, almost all civilians. Now, that is something like between half and a third of the number of British people that died in the whole of the Second World War, just in a couple of bomb explosions over in Japan. Peace groups in Bristol will be running a four-day peace gathering near the Peace Tree on Castle Park, halfway along the footpath and the cycleway overlooking the harbour and Finsel's Reach. Everyone is welcome. The gathering starts with a die-in at quarter past eight on Friday the 6th to remember the time Hiroshima was bombed. On following days, the gathering will start at 10 a.m. and finish at about 6 p.m. So it's quite a big event, really. In the evenings, weather permitting, there'll be lantern lighting. Musicians are most welcome, plus pop-up cinema, information stalls, open-air art gallery, plus drop-in discussion and workshops on nuclear weapons, nuclear power, militarism, arms trade, refugees, climate change, and the whole protest movement generally. There will also be opportunities for protests at military and nuclear-related sites around the Bristol area, .. Now, this has been going on for a long time, this, Martin, hasn't it? But you know, we were hearing about the death of Bruce Kent a couple of months ago, and I think I was saying at the time, well, CND almost seems to have vanished, but they do these regular events like this Hiroshima Day.
Yeah, and it's very much to the point, because as a British government advisor, his name I've forgotten, said this week, we're probably closer to nuclear war than we've ever been. And that's an official government spokesperson. But most people are still blissfully unaware of how dangerous the situation actually is.
Stella?
You two guys are much more up on the geopolitics than I am. But clearly the situation with Taiwan could be another tinder point, couldn't it, you know?
What they're saying in The Sun this week is... DEFCON 1, world is dangerously close to a nuclear war amid threats from Russia, China and North Korea. I'm not sure North Korea are going to nuke Britain, are they, Martin?
Well,
likely or not?
And of course what they're doing is this, it's the enemies that are going to nuke us, it's not us that's going to nuke them, which of course is what they fear. And that doesn't enter into the calculation, does it?
Well, you've heard of the boss of MI6, Dearlove, what was his first name?
Yeah. Richard Dearlove.
Well, this guy here is even better. He's National Security Advisor Sir Stephen Lovegrove, sounding the chilling alarm amid fears that China and Russia are upgrading their weapons of mass destruction. Well, I know we Americans certainly have been doing the same, haven't they? Upgrading nukes, getting ready for a little bit of throwing them around, maybe.
Well, they've also ripped up all of the arms control treaties which they used to have with the former USSR. I mean, the Russians got the message. You're not interested in negotiating about this stuff. So they've upgraded their military so that if there was... Their military doctrine is if any use of nuclear weapons by the West will lead to an immediate extermination strike. We'll just wipe you out. We expect to be wiped out ourselves. But we're never going to use them first. The Chinese have said we're never going to use them first. But the Western powers have always insisted on their right to use nuclear weapons first as a deterrent. Now, they could say we'd never use them first. Most people think that that is the position. That isn't the position. NATO doctrine has always been, we are prepared to use them first. The other side has always got to think that we might use them.
Well, President Truman, when he dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, did a broadcast in the to the world about it. He said that the atomic bomb has been dropped on Hiroshima, Nagasaki, a military base. There might have been a small military base there, but it wasn't a military base.
So in that sense, it's a military base because it's a port.
But anyway, he said, thank God that this has fallen to us to have this. Now, we're not necessarily thanking God right now that the Americans are loaded up with these nukes, are we?
No, and of course what happened in Korea was MacArthur wanted to nuke China, which is why Truman had to sack it.
Yeah, Churchill wanted to nuke Moscow.
That's right.
In actual fact,
the North Koreans were threatened several times with nuclear attack by the Americans, and they just said, go on then, we dare you. And this has been going on for a very long time. Threatening non-nuclear states with nuclear attack has been standard procedure. Now NATO is going to become global NATO, and it's going to deal with the Pacific as well. And it's all going to be based on this idea that we've got to have a complete superiority
over the other side,
that we could be able to threaten them with the first strike.
Not Martin, to be fair to NATO, the United States is already in NATO, and Hawaii is in the Pacific already. So, you know, NATO is already in the Pacific.
Yes, I know, but the point is that NATO should have been disbanded at the end of the Cold War. And in fact, the Russians said, well, what, there's an easy solution here. Why don't we just join NATO? And they went, oh, no, you can't do that, no.
Russia may have steamrolled over the whole of Europe.
If Russia had joined NATO, they would have had a veto over NATO policy, just as Erdogan has got over NATO policy or whatever. And it was a logical thing to go for. I mean, even Putin was talking about it to begin with, and then it became obvious that they just weren't interested. Then they've ripped up all of the agreements that were made. Gorbachev is still alive. He signed most of those agreements, and he supports Russian government policy because there's no, you know, the Russians have been backed into a corner in all of this. The Zelensky was saying maybe we'll have to have nuclear weapons in the Ukraine, and the Russians at that point say no, you're really not, and of course it's actually to do with the asymmetry, because Russia is much closer to its potential enemies than the United States is on the other side of the planet, so it's quite feasible that a short range missile in Western Europe, especially one in the Ukraine or Poland, could hit Moscow within less than 5 minutes. So they haven't got time to work out what's going on. And they can retaliate, but they can't stop a first strike. And that's what the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty was all about, which got rid of cruise missiles, one of our victories of that era. Yeah, we protested against it, and eventually they shook hands and they got rid of those missiles.
You're getting very aerated, as is Mr. Lovejoy, or whatever his name is, Lovecraft, or, you know, the latest lover in charge of our military nuclear policy. But surely this is actually not going to happen. It's mutually assured destruction is going to prevent that. And what we're seeing is a form of saber rattling. It's actually quite an effective form of saber rattling. It's not a saber, it's a nuke. And so people get, incrementally more worried about a nuke being used than they would about a saber.
I think I'm more worried these days with the character who's sitting in the White House at the moment, who potentially is in charge of the nuclear codes. I mean, he's the most worrying person I've ever seen in there, you know. And
Then there's been some pretty worrying.
Is it him or is it his wife who's actually in charge of them? And it really does make you wonder. So, I've grown up all my life with this mutually assured destruction thing. And we've all thought, well, that's great, because that's going to prevent an actual nuclear war. And that's how we've grown up, isn't it, thinking like that. And like you say,
it's not true, because in 1983, a flock of swans, and don't forget all the rhetoric of Reagan and Thatcher and bringing all these missiles in and all the rest of it, the Soviets took that very seriously. They thought they were going to be facing a first strike, and they had spies. They've had one spy at the top of NATO who was eventually caught, who was a German spy, and he was the one who actually said that they're not actually planning a first strike, because they thought they were. Mm. And then there was a flock of swans. They got everything on hair trigger. And they saw this flock of swans, and if the guy pressed the button, we'd have had a nuclear war.
This is the actual the worry. Even if it's an unplanned war,
yes,
something could potentially happen, Stella, couldn't
it?
I mean, especially
depends
as
how automatic their
well, that's
their
what I'm exactly
are,
what I'm
you
thinking.
Know?
You know, have we got AI in charge of it? Have we got some sort of algorithm that's
going to
decide?
That's why they have the intermediate nuclear force. If they've got ICBMs in Siberia and ICBMs in the Midwest, it's at least half an hour before they can hit anything. So if something fired, then you can check. But if it's 5 minutes away and it looks just like any other rocket, both sides in the Ukraine that could easily use their nuclear weapon on the tip of a standard missile.
Or I suppose they think it's possible to shoot an intermediate one down by some sort of ground-to-air missile.
I mean, in Doctor Strangelove, they had the thing where they set up the so-called doomsday machine that once, you know, that... And the Chinese at one stage didn't have their nuclear submarines empowered to fire back because they like to keep that decision within the Politburo. But because of what's all the saber rattling that's been going on, they do what we've always done, which is they have the power to fire back if they think that something's happened without having to go back to Beijing first and say what's going on. Now, the situation could have been diffused. That's what the whole 80s negotiation with the Soviet Union was all about. But instead of building on that, we've just trashed it. Mm. And we've got everything closer to the hair trigger than ever. We're actually got a shooting war going on.
We'll be talking a bit more about Ukraine after the break. But the reason I brought up Hiroshima Day is to try and reiterate this link, really, between nuclear weapons and nuclear power. Because we've got one of the most massive nuclear power stations in the world being built down here near Bridgewater, Hinkley C, and it seems to be taking forever to build. And there's been one of the most important things to note about that is that something is happening on Monday, which is that Hinkley A got switched off years ago. Hinkley B is being switched off on Monday. Finally, it's finished its, I think it's an AGR, advanced gas cooled reactor, that's being switched off on Monday. And the hope, of course, when Hinkley C was first commissioned was that it would be ready to go, on Monday afternoon when Hinkley B was switched off on Monday morning. But of course, it's not. The electricity generation, Stop Hinkley Say, will be ending on the 1st of August, but the UK will be left with its legacy of nuclear waste for thousands of years. Even after generating waste for 46 years, we are still not sure what will happen to it, other than a vague promise that it will be buried underground in a geological disposal facility, a site for which has not been found, Martin.
Well, I mean, the issues of nuclear power is related to that of nuclear weapons. I don't think we'd have had nuclear power if nuclear weapons hadn't existed.
Well, they were,
certainly
that's
the
right.
British nuclear power programme was a spin-off of the nuclear weapons programme.
No, that's right. It was to make plutonium, basically, yeah. Wasn't it, in the reactor?
And the calculation by most states is if you've got nuclear weapons, you might as well have nuclear power on the side. And if you've got nuclear power, you can get nuclear weapons, which is exactly how the Indians got their nuclear weapons. They got a CANDU reactor from the Canadians, which was a civilian reactor, and that was the basis on which they developed their nuclear weapons. So there is a definite link between nuclear proliferation and nuclear power. But of course, there's other issues. Whether nuclear power, I don't think, is really viable economically without subsidy. But once you've built a nuclear power station, you might as well run it, in my view, until its natural life is out, because the waste is going to be there anyway, and you're still going to have to get rid of it. Yep. And that's a real problem, because the waste of all of this is going to last for generations and generations.
Well, again, going back to when we were growing up, the idea was that it would be shot out into space to the Lagrange points. Now, why something solution like that has never been actually thought up? We're supposed to have We're supposed to have unmanned vehicles going to the Moon and Mars. Can't we bury it on another planet somewhere?
Can you imagine if the rocket blew up on the pad? Yeah, full of nuclear waste.
Rocket. Yeah.
Well, that's.
I think the real problem with nuclear waste is that it's existential. I mean, we haven't got a solution for it, and that's why probably we should never have done it, but we've done it now, and now we've got to deal with it.
I remember chatting to a wonderful nuclear engineer, John Large, who died several years ago. He said that there is this possibility of shooting this waste into the sun. That is a possibility. But it's incredibly heavy, and of course you've got to get it out of the Earth's atmosphere. That takes a tremendous amount of energy. The other thing is slipping it down between tectonic plates of the Earth to put it in amongst the magma of the core of the planet. But then again, see, that is not necessary.
The general attitude of the pro-nuclear power lobby has always been, we will find a technical solution at some point. We just haven't got one now. But that is potentially just wishful thinking.
It is.
What they're doing is putting it in fairly safe places where it will last for quite a long time, hopefully. But it's so dangerous that won't last. It won't, you know, civilizations will come and go and the Chernobyl reactor will still be dangerous.
Well, the red hot uranium fuel rods in Hinkley B that are glowing away today, which will be cooling down on Monday. Just looking at the Stop Hinkley release, because they've got some. I'll put a whole copy of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, because anyone that's interested in what goes on, of course, you know they've got the cutting edge of nuclear now is China, but we don't know anything about what goes on in these Chinese reactors. They don't tell you. After closure, EDF's first task will be to agree a safety case with the Office for Nuclear Regulation. Oh, I wonder how many of those civil servants are going to be sacked by Jacob Rees-Mogg, and so whether they'll be able to do that job or not. For fuel handling and defueling, this should take about 3 months. Then around 300 fuel channels in each of Hinkley B's two reactors will have to be emptied and the spent fuel transferred to a cooling pond where it has to remain for at least 90 days. Once it starts to cool down, this spent fuel will be transferred to a transport flask and taken by lorry 10 miles along country roads to a railway siding next to Bridgwater Station main line. There it will be loaded onto a train about 100 metres from Eastover Junior School. Over the next 3.5 years, the frequency of these transfers could increase to 3 or 4 flasks a week. Between now and 2026, 350 spent fuel flasks then will travel by train from Bridgwater up to Sellafield. And I remember, gosh, this is around about 2000. We went and did some filming down near this, Eastover Junior School, at what they call the railhead, where they transfer the fuel. The flasks from a road onto the rail, and had a chat to some of the people around there. And one of the guys was saying, well, yeah, I live right next to, in the social housing with my kids, right next to the place where the rail, where the trains come in to pick it up. And he said, I was looking out of the window. Well, he said, we had to quite often had to have a chat with the guys working for the railways, because they would leave the diesel train, the diesel locomotive ticking over. And they would sometimes have to hop over the garden fence and go and talk to the guy and say, can you please move the train or stop it ticking over? Because the stink is drifting into our house and into our windows and everything. So, he'd done that a few times. One day he jumped over the, wall to go and ask them to move it or turn it off. And they were very helpful. They'd usually just move it a little bit and then it wasn't a problem for him anymore. Or his family. He found in the cab of the locomotive three young kids who'd been playing football, who were playing with the controls on the train, and immediately got rid of them. But he said, well, what the hell do they think they're doing? They all go off for lunch and they leave a locomotive with a nuclear fuel rod flask tied behind it, where the kids can play around with some of the controls on the diesel and send it onto the main line. This doesn't sound like they're being really serious about safety. But anyway, that's the sort of thing that you get, I'm afraid, when you've got the transfer of waste right next to a primary school in a housing estate, which seems like the craziest place to do it. If you're going to do it somewhere else. I mean, there's up at Dumball, a bit further down the line, there's another place they could do it far, far more safely. But anyway, so this is definitely not going away. When defueling is complete, if all goes according to plan, ownership of Hinkley B will transfer to the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority. Well, I don't envy them. They will take around 5 or 6 years to prepare the reactors for care and maintenance. And then finally, final dismantling is expected to begin. Do you want to guess when they're going to finally start to dismantle Hinkley B? Go on, have a guess.
2050. 2090.
Exactly, in between 2017.
Okay.
So both of you did very well there. So it's not going to be for a long, 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 long time. So the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority, Martin, these are basically the people that pick up the tab for all of the money that the...
It's a big tab as well.
It is. But nuclear is becoming, as the price of fuel goes up and gas and energy generally, nuclear is becoming a little bit more viable.
It is, especially when you've got all the sunk costs involved. I mean, the French decided they were going to bet on nuclear power for their own reasons many years ago, And they weren't really economic reasons, they're military reasons and strategic reasons. And once you've spent all that money, it then becomes cheaper to run it than to close it down. What's happened in Germany with the kind of emotional reaction after Fukushima and the strength of green feeling is that they just said, right, no, we want to close it down straight away. And that has actually compounded the dilemma that the German government is now in. Because their whole industry, in fact, is dependent upon relatively cheap fossil fuels from the Urals, and their business model is totally based on that, and they've suddenly realised that's potentially gone.
Yeah, Stella, the Greens are increasingly seem to be liking nuclear. I mean, certainly when I was growing up, the environmentalists hated it because of this massive toxic legacy of radioactive waste for tens or hundreds of thousands of years.
I think you'll find that the Green movement has always been quite split, actually, on use of nuclear. A lot of them did see it as clean energy, and it was the ones who didn't see it as clean energy who won out. But I think you'll find there are different opinions, even in the Green Party in Bristol.
No, I think you're right. And somebody who died this week, aged 103, James Lovelock, he was pro nuclear energy. He was saying, well, actually, this is a key part of the future, Martin.
Well, that's because he was so hot, if you can say it, on climate change. So, I mean, you see George Monbiot's position, because if climate change is the overwhelming issue, then nuclear energy becomes a potential solution, even though nuclear energy itself is quite fossil fuel intensive, you know, building things with concrete and, you know, you need lots of trucks.
Well, and also, excavating the uranium, not to say least of which is getting the uranium out of the ground.
Yeah, well, I think the real choices are now going to face our societies about what we're going to do about all this. My own magical solutions, insofar as I've got one, is from Amory Lovins from the Rocky Mountain Institute in the 1970s. He said the solution to all of this is energy efficiency. It's not new forms of power. Everything we do is destructive in one way or another. Well, Eating food is destructive.
That's one thing the energy industry doesn't want us to do, is use less energy.
Well, that's the whole point. But of course, the thing about making things more efficient, that includes everything, you know, cars. Do you remember when, after the energy shock in the 1970s, new kinds of cars were developed by the Japanese, smaller, went further.
Yeah.
You know, but of course the Americans then went, no, we're not doing that, we want Humvees. Yeah. And that was completely defying the direction of travel that we needed to go.
Well, let's think about it. I mean, during the 1960s and 1970s, particularly up until the oil crisis in 73, there was an attempt to get us hooked on this. I mean, it was as if it was free petrol. You know, if you can get a car, you can travel around for next to nothing anywhere.
Well, that's right. And of course, the US was the world's biggest producer, so they were very keen for everybody to get onto their model of doing it and all the rest of it. I think the thing about getting energy efficiency, which won't happen through the market, you'd need to regulate it and say, right, this is what cars will have to look like. All cars must fulfil these criteria, otherwise you can't build them. That doesn't mean electric cars, it just means efficient cars. And then, of course, it pays for itself. Yeah. Over the long term, if you're more efficient things, it eventually, it's just what capitalism is supposed to do anyway. We could do exactly the same as we do now with a fraction of the energy used. Light bulbs, everything.
What do you make of this, transport, car, energy debate?
Well, everything's planned obsolescence, isn't it? They want everything to be planned obsolescence. Yeah. So you just buy more and more and everything just gets thrown in massive dumps. I mean, that is how society runs.
Well, yeah, getting rid of solar panels. They have a natural life, and in actual fact, they're full of crap. You know, they've got to be very carefully deconstructed. You know, you've got all the different lithium, all the different things in it. You know, you've got to separate them out.
One of the darlings of the left, Michael Moore, made a documentary 2 years ago called Planet the Humans, where he absolutely blew the green energy agenda out of the water. You know, went round, showed what happens when they start decaying, when these things.
Well, what's particularly happening is that the commanding heights of the global capitalist elite have decided that their justification for continued global capitalism is that they're going to save the planet through greenery. Now, this is not the same as the green movement growing up as a grassroots kind of rebellion against consumer society. Mm-hmm. It's them recuperating it for their own purposes. But there are bound to be disagreements about this because, in actual fact, it's complicated.
Isn't it is complicated down at Hinkley, particularly by the fact that we've now had the Taishan nuclear reactor, which is the first working reactor to the same design as the Hinkley design, It's still not going. It was shut down a year ago. It was switched on the year before. A year later, it was switched off, and it's still not on again. So there is now apparently going to be a complete redesign of the core of the reactor at Hinkley C. So another few years added to the time when that can be possibly switched on. But the problem is that the Chinese aren't saying anything about what's going on with their attempts to get their reactor restarted. So it's not so easy for the campaigners here. I mean, I imagine EDF and the people actually building these reactors do know what's going on, but they're not telling anybody. Anyway, I spoke to Roy Pumphrey from Stop Hinkley this week about this rather tragic. If you're working for the, well, actually, no, it's not tragic, is it? As Chris Busby pointed out, actually, this is just more money. They're going to get more money. Whether this thing ever gets switched on or not may not be the point. Maybe the point is the building of it is going to make a lot of people a lot of money.
I'm Roy Pumphrey from Stop Hinkley, and the current situation regarding the reactor is that following the design faults that have been identified at the Taishan reactor in China, EDF are now saying that they'll need to do a redesign of the particular parts of the reactor for Hinkley C, and looking forward for the Sizewell C reactor to make sure that the fault at Taishan isn't replicated in the UK. Of course, EDF are busily playing all this down, and it remains the case that the office, the puppy dog regulator, the Office for Nuclear Regulation, which is usually 100% compliant with whatever a nuclear developer wants to do, will have its say. But I suggest it's highly unlikely that they'll go against whatever EDF come up with as a solution.
We were told a year ago it was just a little hiccup over in China. It does seem as if, the nature of this kind of technology means that when something like that happens, it's impossible to actually go in and fix it because it's far too radioactive in there.
They can, but by shutting down the reactor and giving it time and extricating the parts they need to fix remotely, they can get over that. But it is an extremely tricky process, and one wouldn't want to be involved in what's going on at Taishan for love nor money, which is why it's been shut for over a year, and why they're desperate to do something for Hinkley C and the design for Sizewell C that will stop it happening over here. I mean, it remains the fact that Taishan is the only example of this model of pressurized water reactor that has even started. And the ones in Finland and France, EDF has failed to get to work. The one in Finland sort of stuttered towards life several months ago, but we now know won't be coming on grid until but at the earliest. And we haven't heard anything about how they've reacted to trying to put things right, the fault that's been identified in the reactor in China at Taishan. So, I mean, the implications are very serious. I mean, one of the problems with Chernobyl and Fukushima, as you said, is that dealing with the aftermath of something going majorly wrong with a nuclear reactor is the difficulty of doing anything in the reactor to sort out the problem.
With the fuel price hikes we've got at the moment, actually Hinkley is starting to look a bit more viable, isn't it?
Well, okay, but Hinkley's not going to come on stream before 2027 at the earliest, and my money would be on 2030 as a potential start date, especially with these sort of hiccups. Everything that could go wrong for Hinkley C has gone wrong. The pandemic. Let's go in chronological order. Brexit, which wrecked the exchange rates that everything had been based on. All you hear about the prices for Hinkley C are 2015 prices, okay? They haven't allowed for the real world and real money to intervene. So Brexit was the first major problem. Then we got to, which has created skill shortages, which are ongoing and still existing for Hinckley C. The pandemic, which blew a hole in all their calculations for time and cost. Now we've got the skill shortages again post-pandemic and the difficulty of supposedly being able to raise the workforce from 6,000 to 8,500, which is what they're hoping to do, but they can't find the skilled workers to do it. Then we've got the fact that EDF, the nuclear part of EDF, is now being renationalized in France, and that will mean over here, instead of it being nominally, you know, 85% government owned, it will be the French state that determines what happens with Hinckley C, 100%. So, you know, whatever people might think about the price, it remains to be seen if Hinckley C ever gets to work, what price we do end up paying when that happens. I mean, that price was agreed back in 2015, something like that. I think that's when they signed the paperwork. And I don't doubt that EDF will, because EDF have guaranteed themselves a particular return on investment. And what they're desperate to do is to maintain that, because that's the only basis on which there's any sense in running, in building Hinckley C. So they will doubtless claim something called force majeure to renegotiate upwards the already what appeared exorbitant price for electricity with the government. So that's what they'd be looking to do. It's only a superficial attractiveness.
Okay, look, what do we know about what's actually happened in Taishan and what they're having to redesign for here?
Well, we don't know. And it remains to be seen how major a task it is and how long it takes them to come up with a redesign and whether that actually does get the approval of the regulator.
Well, hang on, because this is nuclear safety. A year on, yeah. We're still being told nothing about what's actually happened.
Very little. ONR just says, to paraphrase, EDF say they're on it, on the case, and that's fine by us. That's basically what they say. So, you know, it's not a pretty picture, that's for sure.
What about the general prospect for nuclear? Because we're seeing, aren't we, quite a lot of pushing of nuclear these days.
Well,
it's not so amazing because something's got to replace these fossil fuels.
Yes, that's absolutely true. But there are plenty of other things up, in the pipeline, and the bodies charged with looking at electricity and power supplies into the future doesn't even see Sizewell C as being a realistic part of making that happen. None of these nuclear reactors are going to come on stream, if they work, in time to help us deal with the current shortage of fuel and power and people's rising bills. The government steadfastly refuses to help people make their homes more energy and efficient, which would immediately reduce the amount of fuel, of electricity and gas they need to do that. Okay, they steadfastly refuse to make people's homes more efficient. And also there's this, it's very difficult. You know, people are so wedded to the motor car that they insist on wanting to drive those, even though, you know, it's a major contributor to climate change and global warming. The electric cars that seem to be, which need electricity, although off-peak would not hurt them at all, to charge them up and keep them going. I don't think, nobody's got a real handle on what's going on. That seems to be as I see it.
Okay, Roy Pumphrey, thanks very much for joining us.
That's okay, Danny. My pleasure.
So that's Roy Pumphrey from Stop Hinckley. I love his answer at the end there. Well, no one really seems to know what they're doing. Martin, this is quite serious, isn't it? Because he said it a couple of times there. They're not even sure if this reactor they've put all these billions, tens of billions into, is even going to work when they switch it on.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? You could, because all this money's been already spent, you then feel that if you cancel it, you're going to lose all that money, which of course you are. But if you carry on, you're going to potentially lose even more money. And that's why this is not a market decision. But it's at the same. This is why Milton Friedman was opposed to any kind of government intervention, because any intervention, you don't know how much it's going to cost, and if it costs more than you thought, you then got to go back and pay more out, because a vested interest develops, and this is potentially the case with something like this. And of course, the Chinese will have developed nuclear power in the first place as a spin-off of their nuclear weapons program, which they felt they had to have because Truman threatened to nuclear attack China in the Korean War, and they weren't going to let that happen. So all of these things are interrelated. And sometimes I think this to me sounds like a white elephant, but existing nuclear power plants, as long as they're functioning, you might as well run them to the end of their natural life and then get rid of them. But we're still going to have a problem to deal with the waste, and we've still got a problem to deal with what we're going to do about immediate crises and so on. But, of course, the immediate crisis with oil and gas is to do with the political crisis. It's to do with sanctions on Russia. If we didn't have sanctions on Russia, there wouldn't be so much of a problem. But because there is, there is. And this is nothing to do with the relative prices of energy in the long run. We need, in fact, as a species, to coordinate our activities. The Chinese obviously have got to be involved in all of this to decide what's the best course of action for everybody.
Okay. Stella, what do you make of all of this?
Well, I think that's a sort of fantasy view of what we would like the world to be like, with everybody sitting down and everybody being friendly to one another and working out for the good of the human race. But it's never ever going to happen, is it? That's the problem. It's never going to happen. Territorial interests will trump everything else. I mean, we went to war in the Falklands to protect a massive oil field that's lying off the Falklands, bigger than Saudi Arabia.
Which all, we never want to use, because it's a fossil fuel.
All the Falkland Islanders have shares in it. They all thought they were going to be millionaires overnight, and now look at it, we're not even going down to get it,
are we? The Argentinians regarded that oil on their continental shelf as theirs.
Absolutely.
And, of course, the Argentinian history is that Britain has developed most of the industries in Argentina, was the colonial power, effectively. Yeah. And the Argentinians endured military dictatorships and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And that oil, which they could use to improve the lives of the poorest of their community, no, they can't have it.
Well, anyway, this week the lights began going off all over Germany. Britain was forced to turn off lights. Will we be forced to turn off lights like Germany? Well, of course, we've already been turning off street lights, haven't we? Experts warn the UK may have to dim street lights and ban hot water in public buildings, as that includes swimming baths. As millions of families face crippling energy bills after Russia has choked off our gas supplies. Oh, hang on a minute. I thought we choked off our own gas supplies by putting sanctions on Russia. Oh, yes, so we did. So, anyway, this is the Daily Mail, after all, so you can't expect too much from them. German cities are switching off hot water and central heating in public buildings and not lighting monuments. Berlin has plunged 200 monuments and buildings into darkness. Hanover has let its fountains run dry. Moves come as Gazprom, Russia's state-run supplier, has cut the flow of gas from the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. So apparently people are worried, Stella, that we're going to be like Germany and going to turn all the lights off.
Well, Germany are landlocked in the middle of a continent, and they're reliant on these pipelines from Russia. They're actually much more vulnerable than we are. So we have got the potential to have wind and water power around, all the way around our coastline, if only we had a government that would get to grips with it and agree to go. I mean, the governments we've had over the last few years, Theresa May's government, pulled the plug on a lot of projects that were, carbon reduction projects. Tidal lagoons, there was plans for tidal lagoons all up and down the southwest coast because of the massive high tidal drop, and all the green groups think they're perfectly safe for wildlife and so on, pulled the plug on all these projects. So we've not had the political will to actually come up with any alternatives, have we, really?
No. It's interesting you're talking about these tidal schemes. Mm. Sitting here in Bristol, I don't know how many times we've mentioned it here, but we have one of the two biggest tidal reaches, yep, of any place on the planet. Of course, we need to have some sort of a barrage to take a load of energy from this sea as it goes backwards and forwards. Anyone that's ever strolled or cycled over the Old Severn Bridge on the south side If you do it at the right time of day, you can see the most incredible currents surging around there, backwards and forwards, as these thousands and thousands of tons of water goes backwards and forwards through the River Severn. It's a gift, isn't it, really?
Well, I was down at the planning inspectorate until I had to retire 2 years ago for other reasons, and these tidal lagoons, they were some of the projects that were coming in, and they were very well thought out, and all the green groups were perfectly happy with them. You know, the biggest issue they had was fishermen who were worried about migrating salmon and things like that. But they were very easy projects. They were very easy issues to sort out, if you know what I mean. There was nothing. And once these things are in place, they have a lifetime of something like 125 years, not the 25 years that the windmills have got. Mm. You know, the tidal lagoon, once you've built it, that's it. And the actual moving parts are very simple. So I have not the slightest idea why we haven't had a government that got to grips with this.
When I first arrived in Bristol in the late 90s, I had a chat because I was working at the Create Centre, which is part of the council, over in Hot Wells. And we had some people there who'd been involved from the council's environmental department, whoever they were. And I had a chat with them about why it was that because there was a proposal for a tidal generation along the cut, because this was used to be used for navigation. It's not used for navigation anymore. An enormous amount of water goes in and out of there. It goes right through the city centre. I mean, it's just a little plant making some power out of this water moving. And you know who it was that stopped it? Friends of the Earth. To do with the wildlife using the mud. I mean, you know, any old excuse, it seems. I look at this country and I think, well, all these basic, simple, honest solutions are being stopped. They're being stopped deliberately. And then maybe we'll get some sort of super-duper leader at some point in the future and make it all happen and everyone will love them for it. The French government, by the way, as was mentioned by Roy Pomfrey there, is taking EDF back into public ownership. The cost of it is to be $10 billion to the French government. So they're taking over it. So we're dealing directly with the French government, not with any kind of private firm. The problem is, Stella, that EDF at the moment, just looking at this story from Reuters here, half of their nuclear power stations in France, that is 13 of the 56 domestic reactors, are offline due to maintenance.
Oh, right.
So something, I mean, maybe that's why they're being nationalised, is because they just cannot keep their reactors going. It's too dangerous.
So the original plan that we had, that France would actually supply us with nuclear power, that doesn't look like it's going to be very viable, does it?
They are forced to repeatedly, EDF have been forced repeatedly to cut its nuclear power output forecast for this year, deepening concerns about the coming winter amid a European energy crisis due to, as they say, the war in Ukraine. But of course, it's not due to the war in Ukraine. It's due to the sanctions that we stupidly put on Russia when that started. So, Martin, half the reactors in France are offline and no prospect of them being switched on anytime soon.
Yeah, well, I mean, the nationalisation in this case is the state stepping in because the private sector doesn't want to touch it. And that's effectively what this means.
They've got to the halfway stage, and rather than have two-thirds of their reactors offline, and they were being rather embarrassed about it, they've said, well, I'll tell you what, why doesn't the government just take it over?
What the French did by allowing the private sector to buy into the nuclear industry was because they drank the Kool-Aid as well. It's got to be private sector. Now, if the EDF had a completely nationalised nuclear industry, then they would probably, they'd still be on the hook for all of this money, but they wouldn't have to pay off the shareholders. This money that they've got to pay to the shareholders is to get back what they used to own. And that's ridiculous. There's a strong case for all of these things to be in the public sector because there's no real competition here. It's a joke. There's just one supplier, so you might as well have it run by the government. Then the government can decide to subsidise it. Yeah, they don't want the collapse of all of their nuclear industry, having spent all this money on it. They can't just leave that to the market. Makes no sense. Now, they may decide in the long run to get rid of it all. That's what I would suggest they should do. But in the short run, that's not going to happen. So you've then got to manage with what you've got, which then means you've got to run it at a loss, which then means it has to be in the hands of the government, because the private sector doesn't take losses. And there's no point paying the private sector to take a profit out of something that makes a loss. That's the same as true of railways or anything else. Yeah? Why give the private sector any money if it's a loss-making thing? If it's loss-making, you decide you want it because it's loss, even though it's loss-making. There's no role for the private sector at all in that. But of course, the answer is that the private sector would actually be quite a small part of the economy if you applied that criteria. Things like health, education, basic infrastructure, banking. The private sector really would be left with social media. And of course, that's no good for the people of the ideologists of the private sector.
Well, let's have a listen now to, what our marvellous mayor of Bristol has got to say about the environment. He, of course, famously went over to Vancouver, 6,000 miles plus to give a TED talk. And then he got Alex Seabrook, Alex Seabrook, who's one of our local democracy reporters, banned him from coming to press conferences because he asked the very, very cheeky and, of course, stupid question. Don't you think there's an element of irony that you're flying all this way to make a talk which you could have done it on Zoom? So he was then banned for asking the wrong question, or the right question. But anyway, this is what this is a little clip from our Bristol's Blairite Labour Mayor Marvin Rees and what he had to say when he went over to Vancouver for that talk. And it's called 10 years, no time is no time. It's not enough time. He's echoing really the speech made by Greta Thunberg here in Bristol and in various other places, really basically banging his fist on the table saying, come on, we've got to get on with it. There's no time. We've got to stop all this fossil fuel use and bring in all these green taxes.
City leaders around the world struggle to get access to the kind of finance they need to unlock their city's full potential. And yet here too, we're not waiting around. In the UK, I'm part of something called the UK Cities Climate Investment Commission. It's our aim to put the UK's biggest cities in touch with the finance they need for that potential to be released. We've identified £206 billion worth of decarbonisation opportunities across the UK, retrofitting, renewals, transition of fleets to electric. And we are making sure that public and private investors are aware of these opportunities across the UK. So here's the thing. Mayors, city leaders, we haven't got time for abstract debates or merely flowery declarations. Our populations want change today. They want change yesterday. The climate crisis we're in demands leadership. And mayors I meet around the world are stepping up into that space to meet the moment. We want and need national governments and international organizations to work with us, to back us, to support us, but we cannot wait for them. The world's top scientists tell us we've got 10 years to turn this thing around. And because of a history of inaction, underperformance, turgidness in decision making, that means that right now we need to make some big bets. And we need to make some big bets on interventions that will deliver change at scale and pace. And I think our cities give us good odds.
So that's Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees speaking over in Vancouver. He's explaining to everybody how to use less fossil fuels and explaining what he's doing. What do you make of what he had to say there, Stella?
I'm 62 years old, and in 10 years' time, the world is going to fry or burn or an ice age. This has been going on my whole life. It's always another 10 years, another 10 years, another 10 years. I mean, Prince Charles has been banging on about this as long as I've been alive as well. When is this another 10 years is all we've got going to stop? You know, you can't keep saying, oh, when's somebody going to do something? Why don't you do something then, Marvin? Why don't you actually take autonomy? You were supposed to be an elected mayor. If you had all these grand plans, for green energy in Bristol, why don't you actually take charge and do it?
He's joining the UK Cities Climate Investment Commission.
Yeah, he's got 2 years because he's our last elected mayor. So how much is he going to get done?
Well, he's doing what he can. I just wondered if you really understood what he was saying in that 2 minutes or so we heard of him there, because I have a problem actually understanding what he's talking about.
It just sounded good, didn't it? Oh, here's all the city mayors getting together. I mean, George Ferguson was doing all this, going around all the cities in Europe. Oh, here are all the city mayors working together. We have heard all this before, haven't we?
We have. Martin, what do you make of your local leaders' talks? You being a member of the Labour Party, of course.
Well, it's just words, isn't it? I mean, when he says the local investment forum, where's the money in the local investment forum for this? Is he talking about getting money from the City of London, from private hedge funds? Or is he talking about public investment? If we're talking about, if you want to do things on a big scale, you need public resources. And when they have the big climate conference in Glasgow, one of the things that was very obviously different from the Bretton Woods conference in 1946 in the US was that the Bretton Woods conference, to basically reorder the world after the end of World War II, there were no financial people there at all. It was governments who made the decisions. You know, the top people from the, you know, in terms of elected governments, military, General Marshall was there. But the idea of having top Wall Street bankers there wouldn't have occurred to anybody, because they'd made a complete mess of the 1930s, and they were basically a nasty smell at that stage. But when it comes to dealing with the crisis in our era, they've got everybody there, all the top CEOs of all the top multinationals, all the top hedge fund managers, they're all there. So why are they the solution? They're not the solution, are they? And this is what's so pernicious about this whole thing, is that it's actually a green wash of a power grab by the financial elites, which should have been extinguished in 2008. That was the real opportunity. When the banking system went bust in 2008, if you'd had a serious government in the United States of America, you know, and there have been serious governments in the past, like Roosevelt or even Truman, they would have just said, right, that's it, private banking finished, bang, that's the end of it. And then, of course, you can do all sorts of things. But, of course, we didn't do that. They were bailed out, and now they're coming to rescue us again from the green, from global warming. I haven't got much to say about nuclear war, which is probably the most dangerous thing we face. And, of course, there will be a lot of global warming if we have a nuclear war, and not many people around afterwards to discuss what we might do about it.
Well, yeah, I can't add much more to that, I don't think.
I just wonder, he's talking about changing the city to make it green, basically. So there's no problem with that, surely. I mean, you know, we could do with green buses. The only problem that I see is that this is all something which he is hoping, as you were saying there, Martin, is going to be done by the private sector.
Well, that's right, because in actual fact, mayors in different jurisdictions have very different levels of powers. And in actual fact, Marvin, at the end of the day, hasn't got hardly any powers. This is what make me laugh about the whole elected mayor thing. The government, the central government, is stripping local authority of its powers to do anything. At the same time, setting up a dog and pony show about elected mayors, who, when they get elected, whoever they may be, and people like, various people putting their names forward, just sort of non-political people like Carol Vorderman. Why shouldn't I be a mayor? But at the end of the day, they haven't got any powers. They can't actually keep the toilets open. Yeah, we haven't got the resources to keep public toilets open. But we're talking about having a green revolution.
I look at Marvin's gobbledygook as a form of sabotage, really. But anyway,
it's normal gobbledygook.
This zero carbon.
That's what he'd say. This is normal gobbledygook. It's the same as everybody else.
Zero carbon stuff. Which is one of the things that he and other Blairites and many others have bought into. Landmark ruling this week, we hear on Sky News, sees the government's net zero strategy ruled unlawful. Campaigners said the illegality of the government's flagship climate change strategy was a huge political embarrassment. A landmark court judgment, and this story is Tuesday the 19th, of July, a landmark court judgment has ruled the UK government's net zero strategy is in breach of the law, as it doesn't explain how targets will be met. So it also finds that Parliament and the public were effectively kept in the dark about a shortfall in meeting a key target to cut emissions. A High Court judgment, published at the Met Office's first ever red alert for extreme heat, said the strategy, which sets out to plan to decarbonise the economy, this is very much the Marvin thing, does not meet the government's obligations under its own Climate Change Act. The ruling from Justice Holgate states that Greg Hands, the Minister for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, responsible for signing off the net zero strategy, didn't have the legally required information on how carbon budgets could be met. He nevertheless approved the strategy. The legal challenges were brought by Friends of the Earth, Client Earth, Good Law Project and environmental campaigner Joe Wheatley were heard together at the Royal Courts of Justice. So the updated strategy will have to be presented to Parliament for scrutiny by MPs. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff, it does come down to people having the wherewithal to actually take this call.
You notice the groups that were involved with that as well. Again, Friends of the Earth, you know, people, it's like, okay, I get what they're saying, that it's all lip service, so that's why they changed it in court, so that it can be seen to be all lip service and not, you know, a real strategy. But again, it's the same, it's environmental groups. What it looks like to a layperson is that they've put a spanner in the works, doesn't it?
Well, what they're saying is, no, you need to be tougher in order to get this net zero through. You've left it in a too woolly a way. Well, it seems to me that what we're doing is we are being masochistic towards ourselves in order to try and do something about which something we can't do anything about, which is mostly generated in China. But anyway, we've got some other stories from local stories. One is the Bristol Waste bosses have resigned this week at short notice from the City Council company, Martin. I don't know if you'd seen that. Bristol Waste is one of these arm's length businesses which was set up to do all the refuse for the city, but no explanation. These two chiefs with their £150,000 salaries have just walked. There was no public announcement at all. Someone just noticed that their names had disappeared off their director's register at Company's House. They've gone.
Well, you know, these arm's length companies are, the problem with them is that they are publicly funded and set up under public auspices, but there's no transparency or accountability. If it was actually owned by the council directly, then you could actually say, well, let's have a look at the books and all the rest of it. It's part of the third way delusion that you know, we can set up things which aren't the state, even though they use the state's money, but they're somehow not directly controlled by us, and therefore it's independent and all the rest of it. But it's a recipe, you know, things that are public should be public, things that are private should be private. And there are cooperatives as well, but they're a special niche, if you like. A lot of what I used to work as the social economy section of the council, and a lot of social economy is effectively spending public money but changing the labels you put on it. And therefore, and then it's entrepreneurial instead of public expenditure. There's another interesting thing this week, which I did send you an email about. Did you see that Acorn, they're a renters union based in, they're not just based in Bristol.
Well, you know what's right in front of me here? Renters storm City Hall and stop Housing Crisis Commission they were excluded from. Our exclusion is clearly an attempt to whitewash its outcomes. Now, I did an article a couple of months ago now, May, I think it was, wasn't it, for Levellers Day, about rent and how rent is actually at the heart of the cost of living crisis, not gas or
fundamental
petrol. This is the moment a group of Bristol renters stormed the first meeting of a new Bristol City Council commission after they were excluded by the mayor. Rent campaign group Acorn burst into the first meeting of the council's Living Rent Commission. It disrupted the meeting with more than 20 members entering the boardroom where it was taking place and stopped the meeting from happening. Members of the community union, which is the biggest representative group for people who rent homes in Bristol, said they had not been invited to take part in the commission. They claimed it was because of the mayor's personal dislike of their campaign. The council set up its Living Rent Commission to investigate renters' experiences and to work towards making Bristol a living rent city. Came after a renters' summit earlier this year, organised by by housing charity Shelter, tenants' union Acorn, and Bristol City Council, which looked at ways to ease the housing crisis. But when the commission was set up, its board of 15 members did not include anyone from Acorn. Now, what we're doing here is the One City Plan, isn't it? The mayor's wonderful One City Plan, where he sets up these little policy boards, which don't involve, Stella, any councillors at all. And in fact, no elected people.
There are councillors on this committee.
Are they on this committee?
Yeah, in actual fact, well, the latest news is that there's a Labour councillor on the commission who used to be the chair of Acorn in Bristol. And what Marvin is saying is because he used to be the chair of Acorn, that is Acorn being represented on the commission. But the Acorn people are saying, no, that's not... That
it's up to them to decide who
well,
goes
Well, that's right. Because he's not a selected...
What a control freak.
Yeah, well, but what's that? Acorn have retaliated at national level because he used to be the national coordinator for Acorn. And Acorn, in fact, has got branches all over the country. It's actually a US organisation. But, you know, in many respects, it's a kind of what you might call a colour revolution NGO, if you like. So it's not just a grassroots movement in Bristol. So there's some questions about who they are, but they've been very, I mean, they have been very effective in Bristol. I know quite a lot of people have done things through them, but anyway, the councillor whose name I've forgotten, he's been kicked out of Acorn as a union, so he's had his membership of the union cancelled by the national executive of Acorn.
Oh dear. So Bristol Housing Chief has been branded a traitor as he's booted out of the community union he used to lead. He has sold us down the river in this way to further his career is a disgrace. The man in charge of housing in Bristol has been branded a traitor, booted out of the community union he used to lead as a row about the City Council's new Renters Commission intensified. Councillor Tom Renard, R-E-N-H-A-R-D, who rose to prominence in Bristol as a leading figure of the tenants' campaign union Acorn, is now the lead for housing in Marvin Rees's council cabinet, described the attack on him as a character assassination. He would continue to work to make positive change on behalf of the people of Bristol. The row came after members of Acorn stormed City Hall on Tuesday, preventing the first meeting of the new commission. Now, it just sounds to me incredible that the mayor has the arrogance to think that he is going to decide who's going to represent an outside body
very much
on his committee.
That sounds very poacher turned gamekeeper.
Well, at the same time, he has the power to appoint anybody he likes to his commission, as we know.
He could, for example, appoint one of the biggest rack renters in the city and say that he should be on the commission.
Well, yes, he could, because the whole model of having an elected mayor is that they can take all of those micro decisions. Now
what he's doing basically is stopping anybody he doesn't agree with being on any of these council policy bodies.
What the article also says is that they're going to be taking evidence from various groups, this commission, and that Acorn will be happy, you know, can give evidence to the commission, but that they can't have somebody sitting on it. Now, I think that what may happen here is that Acorn, I imagine most members of Acorn, and they've got a fairly big membership, are probably either Labour or Green voters, one or the other. And the likelihood is that there's going to be more Green voters at the end of this than Labour voters. And that's the problem that the Labour Party will have in Bristol if they carry on taking this attitude of we're the only ones who know what to do and everybody else
Let me just
to
be
shut up.
Frank about this. It is actually Business West plays a large role in deciding who is going to be on these various commissions. They're business people who are friendly with the Business West and the finance people, the planning speculators, for example.
Yeah, this sounds like a very much a big fish in little pond situation, doesn't it?
It's a paper exercise.
Is this commission going to fit in with the white paper that's going through at the moment, which has some very interesting changes to rent situation, which is going to cover the whole country? So I'd be very interested to know how they're going to fit in with that.
The whole thing is just going to be a whitewash, as they always are. If the mayor and Business West choose all the people on the commission, all they're going to get is they're going to spend a lot of money on these meetings that don't actually discuss anything useful
and
important.
A load of chit-chat among themselves, and the government bringing a white paper, which they have... Have they had any input into it at all? And are they going to...
Frighteningly, they might have. You know, some of the mayor's mates have decided. It's actually a kind of clique. It's running the city by clique.
That may be the case, but there are wider issues about national issues about renting. And, of course, Acorn isn't just based in Bristol.
No, that's right.
And
they would be an extremely useful people to have on any
group. They are obviously fed up because they feel as if they've pushed the issue for years. That's why there is a commission, and they expected that they would be allowed to have somebody sitting on that commission.
Sure, I'm going to do a little bit of fishing, seeing if I can get some one of these Acorn people in on the show in the next few weeks.
Well, they seem to have taken a very hard line on it as well. You know, they're not going to take
well, they've
this
been
line
pushed
down,
around, aren't they? Like a bullying landlord by the council. Anyway, I thought the council was supposed to represent us, not the bullying landlords. Anyway, work stops. Final story before the break. The work stops at a landmark. Of course, this is related to this. A landmark Bristol Tower block development as builders go bust. This is a little bit worrying, isn't it? Because I thought there was such a phrase called safe as houses, and it was actually quite a definite that if you built houses and if you built a tower block that you were going to get your money back, but apparently not. So work to complete one of Bristol's flagship housing developments has stopped after the firm building it went into administration. The 17-storey Boatyard development already dominates the skyline next to the River Avon on the Bath Road in Totterdown, but the immediate future of the development is in doubt after the collapse of the developers, and now the housing association that have been selling shared ownership affordable flats are left hoping the administrators appointed to sort through the collapse of the mid-group, they're called, can quickly find another developer to complete the project. So people have been paying money for flats early on, hoping to get a flat, and now they might never get built. The Boatyard was nearing completion, scheduled to finish this year, and Clarion have been marketing the apartments since early summer. Work stopped last week, and on Thursday, workers from the mid-group were told their jobs were lost, that the company was in administration. Martin, this is a little bit worrying, isn't it? This is the sort of thing you see in collapsing economies, isn't it? The company's just about to finish building and start to get the money coming in. One wonders if this is a little bit like Hinkley might end up being, that you end up with just a shell of a building.
Well, the smart money, in my view, is on a property collapse in this country. And at the same time, because the property market has been defying all of the other signals in the economy. You know, you've had a pandemic, skill shortage, inflation, but house prices and property prices have continued rising. Now, that, in fact, that's not... And, of course, when property prices start going down, they don't just go down a bit. The danger is that it becomes a collapsing market, especially if it's gone up a hell of a lot in the first place. And
could it be possible that this business has actually made quite a lot of money in the contract to build these, and has now decided, right?
Well, that'll be exactly why they've pulled out.
Let's
go. They don't want to deal with the consequences.
Okay, so
they've made their money and they're off now.
Well, that's right. They're looking at a certain price on their balance sheet that they're going to sell these flats at, and now maybe they've realised, crikey, we're not going to get that. Let's just take the money and run.
Well, it may be also that their costs have gone up, which they didn't calculate. And of course, the British economy, I mean, the US economy went into recession this week. Recession is officially two quarters of negative growth. We haven't got there yet in Britain. The economy's dead in the water, but it doesn't just slow down a little bit. The danger is with the raise in interest rates to offset various, you know, tax cuts, for example, by Liz Truss. The Bank of England basically flagged up, well, we'll have to raise interest rates if you do that. That then means mortgage rates go up, which then means that the whole thing starts to topple.
And Putin has been saying that the West is likely to actually inflict a food shortage on itself by the extreme sanctions that it's put on to Russia.
Even if the war in Ukraine hadn't happened, you've still got the basic cycle of the way that, you know, the Western economy has been going. It collapsed in 2008. It was bailed out by the governments. It then kind of crawled back. But of course, it was never, you know, don't forget the quantitative easing was supposed to be something that would happen for a few months in an emergency. That was originally how it was perceived. And in actual fact, every time they've tried to reduce it, they found they can't. And the same has been true in Japan since the 1990s. They've never been able to stop doing it. Now, you can't carry on for decades doing something like that without a consequence. And, of course, the consequence is that, in actual fact, it's all bust.
It's always a bubble, been bust. It's a bubble, folks.
And it's going to go. Now, the question is the real question on the global level is the Chinese economy a bubble? Because they're having similar problems with their property market. But, of course, they've got state-owned banks. And
I'll
they
tell you
can
what,
ultimately
tell you who is
wipe
doing,
the debts out.
Who is doing very well is Centrica, Shell and BP. Their profits are absolutely through the roof, aren't they?
That's right, but that's because the
one isn't of it five times? Centrica's profits are five times higher than last year.
Yeah, but I mean,
the
spot market allows speculators to make money out of crisis. And, of course, spot markets in things like this shouldn't really exist, or only a very minor bit, you know, to hedge against major...
Well, come on, it's a big casino, didn't you know that?
Well, I know, but I mean, it's in actual fact, these are fundamental. It's like the blood supply of a person being determined, you know, by a vampire, isn't it? You know, it's dangerous.
It shouldn't be, it shouldn't be. Anyway, Stella, what do you make of this idea that, you know, we've got these enormous projects just coming to completion in the city, and one of them has just gone bust, literally, a few months before it's due to open its doors.
Was that going to be private flats or rented flats?
Yeah, it's private flats. There's supposedly some affordable in it, but in actual fact, they're affordable. What
does
that
mean? Not be. There may not be any more.
Right. Well, that's the first thing that will go. They'll say because of force majeure, the private, you know, we're not going to be able to sell these.
They even have been negotiating to try and get rid of the affordable housing in there, and found the council saying no.
What happened in 2008?
As a result,
what happened in 2008 down the docks there? As one of the Lib Dem councillors, whose name I've forgotten, told us, because he's the councillor for that ward, was that there lots of private developments went bust in 2008, and they ended up being taken over by housing associations. Because ultimately, it is the state that has to underpin the economy. And we always used to know that. We used to learn it in our lectures at university.
Yeah,
but somehow we've forgotten about it.
Maybe it was Mark Wright, who was Lib Dem councillor in the city centre.
Yeah, it was him.
He explained to us that the General Hospital, which was sold off by John Savage, boss of Business West, to developers, that they had originally agreed to have a whole load of affordable housing in there. And before they even started work, they said to the council, oh, well, I'll tell you what, let's just not bother with the affordable housing because we want to take the profits from building luxury housing.
This has been going on in Bristol forever, absolutely forever. I mean, I remember when all the development was being built on the other side of the river along past where the Great Britain is, all that lot of housing there. There was massive controversy back in those days about how much affordable housing there was going to be. And they ended up, I think, with 30 flats. There are actually 30 flats on that side of the river, tucked in among, you know, just off Coronation Road there, and you know you don't even know they're there. They don't advertise them much.
They're not actually affordable either.
Well, there are people from the council waiting list, but they don't advertise them on the actual where you can go and bid for housing. They're not really advertised. In fact, I knew people who actually got flats down there by word of mouth, like personal exchanges.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all of these crises are coming to a head, and possibly sooner than people think.
Yeah, there's all sorts of projects being put forward for building in Bristol. I wonder whether they're even going to get built.
What happens if there is a crisis? It all just grinds to a juddering halt. It's happened before. There's no reason why it wouldn't happen again.
No, there certainly isn't. Anyway, thank you for being with us, Stella Perrett, Radical Cartoonist. I'll put a link up to your... you said you emailed me a... I'm afraid I'm a bit hopeless on email, but it usually takes me a few days to get emails, let alone answer them. In fact, a colleague of mine this week sent me a great text, which I laughed for about 5 minutes when he said to me, "Email is for losers." I did feel like, absolutely feel like
as,
that at the
as
time.
As an artist, email is the most reliable way to send actual artwork.
Yeah, except
on
to
PDFs
me.
And things.
Except to me. Anyway, so okay. So Stella Perrett.
Just because you don't answer.
Radical Cartoonist, I don't even read it. Radical Cartoonist, thanks ever so much for joining us. And also for Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, or even Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We'll be back to talk about Ukraine, etc., etc., and also to look at the victims of the vax after the break.
what they learn is true, or if it's only lies, just get them through the factories into production. I get them into line. Late in the afternoon, the children all come home. They mind their manners well. The little lives are all laid out. Their hearts, she clips their wings off, they never learn to fly. Our poor mama needs a source of pride, a doctor's son she'll have, no matter what the cost to manhood or to soul. Ooh, sunshine down brightly shine down on all the land, shine down on the newborn lambs, a butcher's knife is in his hand. Lives in a mountain like they see on TV. Down in the heart of town, the devil dresses up. He keeps his nails clean. Did you think he'd be a boogeyman? Oh, mama's stuck with sagging dreams. She'll sell a son or two into some slavery that's lucrative and fine. Just teach them not to criticize, to yes the bosses, impress the clients. Our teachers of the world, teach them to fake it well. Our school bell go ding dong ding, the children all line up, they do what they are told, take a little drink from the liar's cup.
We
So that's Pink Floyd with Another Brick in the Wall. Sometime, gosh, it must have been 1980s. Before that, we had the amazing Buffy St. Marie, S-A-I-N-T-E, Marie, with her Suffer the Little Children. I don't know if you noticed the theme there on education and abuse of kids in education. But also, we started off with Let Us With a Gladsome Mind. That was the Paisley Abbey Choir. So, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the new talkradio.co.uk stream. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. And I'm not sure if actually that might be talkradio.org.uk. Gosh, isn't it awful? I don't even know that. But anyway, whatever it is, whichever one it is, whichever one you dial in and this pops up and you can hear us, bookmark it, please. So, Martin, we're going to start by looking at straight away pretty much at Ukraine. And I noticed that the head of MI6 has decided that he's got a few things to say about that on Channel 4 this week. Of course, you know, as usual, they've been completely unbalanced about everything, blaming the Russians for it all. Whereas you and I know, and anyone with half a brain cell that bothers to look into it knows, that this thing has been brewing ever since Victoria Nuland's $5 billion coup back in 2014.
Well, that's right. Everybody thinks that they know what happened because it's all been presented to them as the, and they keep saying this, the unprovoked invasion of Ukraine.
Sovereign Ukraine.
No,
the sovereign Ukraine. It's not sovereign anyway. It's not a sovereign country. Forget it, mate. It's run by the Yanks. The CIA run.
Well, indeed. But I mean, they keep saying unprovoked, unprovoked, unprovoked. And Caitlin Johnson's got a very good article about this week. And she's saying,
well, good, isn't she?
Why do you keep saying unprovoked? That's because it was provoked. That's that you wouldn't say the, you know, if everybody could see it was unprovoked, then you wouldn't have to keep saying it. But they keep saying it. In actual fact, of course, it was quite deliberately provoked. And, Zelensky, in fact, at one stage was trying to wriggle out of having a war, but he was told by his own extreme right that he was going to have one whether he liked it or not. And then Britain in particular has played a particularly bad role in encouraging the idea that we're going to, you know, there's got to be a war and you're going to win it, all of which is absolutely delusionary. Although you're not going to hear any sense about that from anywhere on the mainstream political spectrum in this country.
We did discuss last week, didn't we, the idea that the Russians are going to extend their aims. Of course, many in the West would say, well, that's very cynical. They were lying from the very start.
They, if you remember, they made a proposal to NATO about a security architecture for Europe. So their aims were never just about the Ukraine in the first place. What they want is short-range nuclear weapons out of Europe, which, of course, we had by agreement before the West ripped up those agreements which Gorbachev and Reagan signed all those years ago. And in actual fact, from the Russian point of view, this is existential. We're not having short-range missiles pointed in our face. The other thing they could have done instead of going to war in the Ukraine was to put nuclear weapons in Cuba, which they did in 1962, and we all know what happened. The Americans would, you could say, well, the Americans say, well, you know, it doesn't make any difference. We're never going to use them. They're just there to protect Cuba. And the same could be said about the Western European countries like Poland and Romania. We're never going to use them.
But they're very good for intimidating.
Of course, the Americans
would
never accept
that. Nuclear weapons are terrific for intimidating people, aren't they?
Well, they're not really. They're not really, because ultimately the thing about nuclear weapons is, as I said earlier in the first hour, the North Vietnamese were threatened with a nuclear attack several times. And they just said, go on, we dare you. Because in actual fact, you won't dare to do it. And there have been various possibilities of the West threatening to use nuclear weapons, yeah. And they haven't when it comes down to it.
This is a real danger, isn't it, where you've got such powerful weapons that you've threatened to use several times. People will think, well, you know, this...
Especially if you don't use them, having threatened to use them.
Yeah, this is your crying wolf, you know. But anyway, the MI6 chief these days, we were talking about Richard Dearlove, the previous chief, earlier on, these various lovers who are the British policymakers on nuclear war, is the now the boss is a guy called Richard Moore these days. And he has said that he believes that Putin's plans will collapse within weeks and Russia is running out of steam. So let's have a listen to what he had to say on Channel 4 News this week.
Moscow's ambitions and what they can actually achieve militarily are worlds apart. a point made by the US's top general today, who said Russia was advancing at just a kilometer a day in the Donbass.
The Ukrainians are making the Russians pay for every inch of territory that they gain. And advances are measured in literally hundreds of meters. Some days you might get a kilometer or two out of the Russians, but not much more than that. So high cost, battle of attrition, grinding, not lost yet in the Donbass, and the Ukrainians intend to continue the fight.
The head of MI6 said today he believes Russia's about to run out of steam in Ukraine.
Our assessment is that the Russians will increasingly find it difficult to supply manpower, materiel over the next few weeks. They will have to pause in some way.
Yeah, so they'll have to pause, Martin. Actually, I would have said a kilometre a day is reasonably good.
Yeah, well, this makes, in the First World War terms, that would be definitely winning, wouldn't it? Well, they're missing the point about the special military operation in the Ukraine. The civilian population of the Donbass and Luhansk voted over 80% to secede from Ukraine in 2014. They were then attacked by the Ukrainian army, which ended up killing 14,000 people, but they managed to organise themselves to fight back. Then after the Battle of Debaltseve, where they surrounded the Ukrainians in a pocket, they were driving them back, and they could possibly have won at that stage, but they were stopped by the Russians saying, no, stop, we'll get a ceasefire and we'll have a negotiation. Now, the fact is that all of these populations, the Russians don't want to kill them because they're trying to liberate them from the Ukrainians, who have in fact been carrying out all sorts of human rights abuses against these people. And it's the same, the Russians haven't lost in Syria. The Russians and the Syrian army have won the war in Syria, not completely, because there's always going to be another phase, but they did it by being absolutely systematic, by surrounding jihadis from al-Nusra Front and from ISIS and so on, trying to negotiate with them, you know, put down your guns and we'll let you go, or we'll even let you go with your weapons. Yeah, and you don't just go in there and kill everybody and blow everything up. That's shock and awe, Western style. And when they invaded Iraq, it took them longer than the Russians have taken to get to Baghdad and to pacify the whole country. And then, of course, in actual fact, it all blew up in their faces as soon as they'd done that. The Russians aren't doing that, are they?
No, they're not. You mentioned Caitlin Johnson, the phoniest, most PR-intensive war of all time. I think she's... if I had a national newspaper, even a regional newspaper, I'd put her on as one of the main columnists. She's an absolutely brilliant writer. She's picked up on this Vogue magazine thing with Zelensky and his missus on the front page of Vogue. The President and First Lady of Ukraine have posed for a romantic photo shoot with Vogue magazine. Zelensky waxes poetical about his love for his darling wife.
Well, that's right. He's also been at Glastonbury, the Golden
Globe
Awards.
How is Zelensky making time for his Vogue photo shoot amongst his busy schedule whilst fighting the biggest war his country's ever seen? I mean, this is all after the same Zelensky who's been so busy making video appearances for the Grammy Awards, the Cannes Film Festival, the World Economic Forum, and probably the Bilderberg Group, as well as having meetings with celebrities like Ben Stiller, Sean Penn, Bono and The Edge from U2, as well as I think it was Richard Branson was over there too. It's as busy a PR tour as he could possibly have without having a discussion. Maybe there's some sort of drug that helps fuel him through all of this manic activity he's having to do the whole time. And there isn't there a war or something happening in Ukraine? You'd think he'd probably be somewhat busy with that too. Call me crazy, Caitlin says, but I'm beginning to suspect that there might be a concerted effort to manipulate the way we think about the war in Ukraine.
Well, that's right. I mean, there are literally scores of Western PR firms who have offered their services to the regime in Kiev for free. So they've all got little projects. So a lot of what we're seeing is, some of it is psychological warfare operations. It's not just PR like the front of Vogue. The sharp end of it is probably what happened at Bucha, where the SBU went in there and executed...
Butcher,
and of course the name will have, yes, it sounds like Butcher, doesn't it? And they went in there and liquidated what they regarded as traitors and collaborators. And then on the back of that, because of course the Russian army had withdrawn 3 days before when these bodies were filmed, and they couldn't possibly, they weren't 3 day old bodies. And they're not only making stuff up, they're actually carrying out atrocities themselves with the advice of military advisors, which is then spun as Russian atrocity.
On VK.com or Facebook, where I always share stuff to both of those these days because Facebook is so flaky, they're selling this war like soap powder, basically. This is an advertising. So as you're looking at a news bulletin, what you're actually seeing is an ad for a war.
That's right. And of course, the consensus view within the Western intelligence services, they're going to push this idea that the Ukrainians are not losing, that they are going to win in the end. And that's why we've got to give them loads more money. And by the way, spend a lot more money on our own military, even though we've actually got other things we'd rather spend it on.
Oh, Russia's running out of steam. Apparently, that's what we heard at the beginning of the top of the hour, isn't it? Russia's running out of steam.
Well, I mean, the First Guards Tank Army, which is really the elite of the elite of the Russian armed forces, is all still in its bases around Moscow. None of them have been committed to this fight. The reason being that the Russians expect that this may escalate into a full-on fight with the whole of NATO. So that's why they haven't committed all of their forces to it. The British didn't commit all of their forces to Northern Ireland for the same reason. That in actual fact is just one theatre of the war, and we don't want to commit all of our forces to that. And in any case, the 1 kilometre a day that they are making is exactly the kind of speed they are trying to rebuild as they take over where they're taking over. And they're not looking for a quick victory. And of course, the longer it goes on and the sanctions have turned out to be a boomerang, the sanctions are going to destroy the West European economy. The Russians just have to watch.
MI6 chief, whatever his name is, Moore, he said it was a significant reminder for the rest of Europe that this is a winnable campaign by the Ukrainians. That's what he said, quote.
That's the line, isn't
it? As allies brace for what will be a pretty tough winter, he also says, while the impact of Europe trying to wean itself off dependence on Russian energy is felt. Offering a quote from the TV series Game of Thrones, he said, winter is coming. And clearly in that atmosphere, with the pressure on gas supplies, we are in for a tough time. Well, he's saying we are in for a tough time, not the Russians. We are in for a tough time. That's your MI6 box, folks, telling you that you are in for a tough time. Because a certain chap called Richard Moore, the head of MI6, has said you're in for a tough time because of our sanctions policy. Now, MI6, of course, will have been deeply involved in deciding that sanctions policy in the first place. So this is a masochistic reaction and a masochistic response. Maybe that was always planned, Martin.
I think that they miscalculated massively by provoking the Russians, which they deliberately.
But you were saying earlier about spreading chaos. This is what these people are doing. They're the lords of chaos. They're spreading chaos. They're spreading the threat of starvation for their own people, food shortages for their own people.
What they're doing is
economic collapse for their own people. The inability of their own people to actually heat their homes, pay their bills, or anything like that. It seems to me that this war in Ukraine is actually a war on ordinary people in Britain too.
It is, obviously. And the Russians, in fact, haven't cut off the supply of gas to the Ukraine or to anybody else. They've just said, if you want it, you're going to have to pay very reasonable agreed prices, because we're not just going to charge you the world market price because we already had a deal with you. But you'll have to pay us in rubles because you've basically impounded all of our euros and dollars.
But in the background to all of this, we've got Taiwan as a terrific cartoon, Mint Press News cartoon this week, with some American Uncle Sam with his elbow lying back on Ukraine, setting fire to it with petrol, whilst he's got a telescope. And in the sights of his telescope is a little island called Taiwan, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is these are the provocations carried out in the Ukraine to provoke the war. And the West knew what they were doing.
But look, let's just look at Taiwan for a minute.
No, but I mean, I'm coming to the Taiwan.
Okay, something really important, I think. I mean, I didn't know this until just checked it up on antiwar.com, that Biden has had a phone call with President Xi. Xi has told him not to play with fire over Taiwan in this two-hour phone call. Mm-hmm. We heard last week, didn't we, Nancy Pelosi was threatening to go and visit Taiwan, and the Chinese were going nuts about that. Maybe they would just invade Taiwan while she's there, stop her leaving, and, you know, kidnap and imprison her, you know, there'd be, I think there'd be that it's not, you know, it's unlikely that that's that'll happen. But it's the sort of thing that the Chinese and the Russians are getting more and more confident, aren't they? They're fed up for years and years with putting up with what the Americans are doing around the world, and now after what's been going on in Ukraine, they're both of those big superpowers are getting much more confident. Pelosi is leading a delegation to Asia, but whether she's not telling anyone whether she's going to be stopping in Taiwan or not. This is infantile, and yet the potential World War III hinges on it.
Yeah, well, I understand the Pentagon has briefed that they don't think it's a good idea, and that is what's put the kibosh on it. And the Pentagon don't think it's a good idea because if the Chinese do react militarily, the Pentagon won't know what to do. They're sending the USS Ronald Reagan, which is an aircraft carrier, into the area. But all that will happen with that, if the fighting starts, is it will be sunk. Now, there's never been anybody of this level going to Taiwan in the last 25 years since the agreement was made that Taiwan is officially going to be regarded as part of China. Now, that was a very unsatisfactory sort of solution, if you like, but at least it was both sides.
Americans have got all sorts of problems because of the trade war that they've started with China. They can't get their chips and things like that. So the House of Representatives this week has passed a $280 billion, yes, that's over a quarter of a trillion dollars, industrial policy bill meant to counter China. The legislation has already passed through the Senate and now heads to President Biden's desk. On Thursday, the House passed a massive $280 billion spending bill meant to counter China in a vote of 243 to 187, with no Democrats voting against the legislation and 24 Republicans voting in favour. The bill's already passed through the Senate and now heads to Doc Biden. The CHIPS and Science, CHIPS, capital letters, and Science Act 2022 includes $53 billion to subsidize the domestic production of semiconductor chips and $24 billion for tax incentives and other purposes. The bill will authorize $200 billion in science and technology research funding. You spread across several government agencies over the next 5 years. Now, so this is the idea, is that we are way behind in technology, with people like Huawei are able to produce this stuff much better, much quicker than us. So the Americans have realized, oh crikey, we can't compete. We're going to have to throw loads and loads of money at R&D in high tech stuff so that we can start producing the same sort of thing that China is nowadays.
Yeah, and of course the US used to constantly argue that the Chinese were not really a market economy because they were subsidizing stuff and therefore they shouldn't be allowed to sell their stuff into the world
now,
market.
If you go back to an interview we did, gosh, must be 6-8 months ago now, with Doctors Chris Exley and Chris Busby, entitled "Is Science Dead?" We had a great discussion there, and one of the things that came out of that was Chris Busby explaining that he cannot get papers published in scientific journals in the West, that he has to get them published in China. So basically the publishing, the free press, is alive and well in China now, so long as you don't want to criticize President Xi or policies of the Chinese Communist Party in these journals. But his research on the dangers of nuclear power, for example, and the leukemia clusters around nuclear, is all being published in Chinese and then being translated back at some point a few months down the line into English. So what you've got in China is a genuine interest in scientific and technological innovation. What you've got in the West is a whole bunch of monopolies that are even controlling the publications of journals in their area to make sure that their monopolies are not threatened by scientists or anybody else that might say, hang on, why are you doing it this way? Wouldn't it be better to do it that way? So you've got a free press in China in that to that extent, but not in the West.
Well, this has been an ongoing source of potential conflict for years. But because of the trade war on China that Trump started, and then, of course, it wasn't ended by Biden, the Chinese and the Russians, the Russians have just had all their foreign reserves, $300 billion worth, confiscated. Now, once you've done that to them, you can't really threaten them with much else. What else are you going to do? And, of course, at that point, you might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb. We're not taking any... And even if it was hurting you, you might say, well, we're not taking any notice. But, of course, it isn't really hurting them, because China is probably Russia is the one country in the world that probably is capable of having an autarkic setup, because they've got all of the natural resources they need in the country. China is the workshop of the world. And ultimately, there's no reason why that should lead to a collapse in the West if we were to cooperate with them and about how to manage it all. But the determination by the deep state in the West to prevent the rise of non-Western countries into the future world is what's causing this problem. And the Chinese and the Russians do not want a global war, or certainly not a nuclear war. But they've run out of patience with being told what to do by people who are basically just pursuing selfish interests. And I've got to know it, the interests of ordinary people in their own country don't matter. Never mind people in Africa.
Meanwhile, this week, President Biden is warning he may attack Iran. Every threat from the US makes Tehran more likely to build a nuclear bomb, is what the American conservative website says. For years, US presidents have threatened war with Iran. Often mouthing the anecdote, all options are on the table. Joe Biden is the latest believe he can scare Tehran away from developing nuclear weapons by threatening war. It doesn't make sense.
Well, I mean, the answer to that is what the Iranian general staff did after the assassination of Soleimani. They had a think about what to do, and then they gave the Americans a warning saying, we're going to attack your main base in Iraq. Get your tin hats on, get into your bomb shelters. And then they landed loads of missiles directly on the top of those bomb shelters. Now, the Americans didn't do anything because they knew if they fired back, they would start the war and the Iranians would win, because using their missile technology, they would sink virtually all the ships in the near vicinity and wipe out all of the bases. And they could easily have wiped out all of the Saudi Arabia's oil facilities, for example. That would have then led to their oil facilities being wiped out. But, you know, if it's a national survival thing, then that's what it's about. There is no viable strategy for NATO and the West to beat even Iran fighting on its own. Never mind Iran, China and Russia as a coalition. It's not even worth discussing. You're never going to beat them.
Okay, well, we're going to move on now to look at the victims of the vax. This was a terrific program, and I'm saying this week after week these days. Mark Stein, Steyn, on GB News, always worth tuning in to. And this is a program he did last week, a little excerpt from it called Victims of the Vax.
Everyone, we're supposed to bang saucepans for the NHS, but all the stories I hear of going to a hospital, being sloughed off, being told it's nothing to do with the vaccine, being sent home, take two aspirin, and if it doesn't clear up, get back to us. Are there other people who have been poorly treated by the NHS in this, where the doctors did not respond well to it?
2 weeks, I struggled to get...
For 2 weeks, yeah.
So I struggled to get recognised by my doctors. I was ringing them after I had my vaccine. I had numerous side effects pretty much straight on, right within the first few hours, crashing headaches. Mm. I couldn't think. My head was just like a solid block, and they just wouldn't listen to me. They said, don't worry about it, it's just normal side effects. And every couple of days I'd ring in, the same thing. And at some point I thought it must end. Mm. But they just still wouldn't listen. And they said... And they rolled into the second week, and we'll get you in, we'll get somebody to check you over. That didn't happen. And then I had the same thing again, just keep ringing back. And then 2 weeks to the day I'd had my vaccine, I was in desperation. I'd lost all consciousness of how serious ill I was. I couldn't talk. I was stumbling. And my doctor spoke to me on the phone, and he said, well, I need to see you now. You sound that serious on the phone, I need to see you now. And I jumped into my car, and without awareness of how bad I was, I just jumped into my car and got there somehow. And they called the ambulance within seconds of seeing me. Because I couldn't walk down the corridor to his office. He just saw me stumbling.
That's just extraordinary. The point to remember here is that they know who's suffering from what in each hospital. The Office of National Statistics has become very selective about which statistics it releases. The UK Health Security Agency has become very selective about what statistics it releases. But they know the numbers.
So that's Mark Steyn there on GB News. Martin, it's quite clear that there was a reluctance amongst healthcare professionals in many parts of mostly in the Western world to take seriously people who are having problems after having vaccines. It was just seen as our job is to get those vaccines into people's arms, not to to cause problems, get in the way of those vaccines going into arms by saying, well, actually, that some people are actually getting ill after having the vaccine. And potentially, if they're young people, then they probably don't need to have the vaccine in the first place.
Well, I mean, it was said at the very beginning, was it not, that, I mean, these vaccines were brought into use all over the world without going through the normal procedures that you would follow for checking safety
and
vaccines.
Of course, they were indemnified against it, the vaccine companies. Well, Mark Steyn there, I'll put a link up to the whole programme because he got a whole load of people into the studio. Did a terrific job. Nice production, folks. It's the sort of thing the BBC used to do back in the 1970s, you know, get it sorted all out, get everyone in there talking. And they had the first people to be compensated as well, who were compensated for family to be compensated for losing a loved one, definitely due to vaccines. But one of the best people, I think, on this generally is the Dr. David Halpin. I spoke to him exclusively a couple of weeks ago on this very topic, and he thinks that there is a serious problem with the jabs, that they're actually interfering with the body's cells' ability to simply reproduce in the normal way.
You might call it anecdotal, but I have a very observant, wonderful friend called Jo Clark Irons in Torquay. She gardens professionally. She has about seven or eight customers. So she sees people close up, all who've been obedient and have done what Mr. Johnson and Mr. Professor Whitty have told them to do, and Valance with his shares in SmithKline French. They've done that, and she's noticed that they have been aging quickly. There's the cellular mechanism is called apoptosis, APOPTOSIS. That is cell death. When you examine cells under a microscope, you can see dead cells because the nuclei become dark. They die. Some cells turn over rapidly, like skin cells, things like chondrocytes make our cartilage, the stuff within the cartilage. I can go into that, know a lot about that. But they're much slower. But I think that apoptosis has been speeded up by the toxic junk. That's just a feeling I have. Just as I have another feeling. This is a digression, Tony, but it's very important. If you want to get a bioweapon, when you want to have your enemy hamstrung, you do what they did in around 2011 in Gaza. You shot 12-year-old boys in the groin or knee. They weren't killed by it. There's over 22. They're on a paper of mine called The Methodical Shooting of Children. If you just put in methodical, up this paper comes. The BMJ and the Lancet wouldn't print it. But I said it was an epidemic at the time, or at least a small outbreak due to the elemental evil where an Israeli member of the Israeli occupation force uses his sniper rifle with parts produced in Britain to shoot a dear child who's scrabbling for concrete fragments near Erez checkpoint where they've been bombing so that they can make some stuff for concrete for rebuilding the houses they've been bombed. They were earning a few shekels a day with their donkeys and carts, and they were being shot from the watchtowers along the so-called border with Gaza. I'm digressing from that, but I'm talking about elemental evil. Elemental evil. It's all round us, Tony, but we are winning, because out of this terrible, this global administration of this toxic junk, is a lot of death and injury. People's brains are being affected. I know certain of that. I see it in my own family. I see rather rapid aging. Some of the loss of memory may be aging itself, but I think it's been speeded up by this damn stuff. I'm sure of it. I was going to say this. Alzheimer's disease now affects 800,000 people in this country. They're projecting that by the year 2030 there'll be 1.3 million. If you want to hamstring your enemy, then you shoot a child in the groin. So they spend. You need four doctors looking after him, or soldiers. You shoot them in the leg. If you want to get a bioweapon, which involves millions and millions of carers and millions of pounds in paying for those carers, then you affect their brains. I cannot prove it. I've yet to see the evidence. But I question whether Alzheimer's has been introduced in one of the flu vaccines, or several of them.
So that's Dr. David Halpin. Very, very cautious with his words, Martin, but he's saying that potentially these jabs are vectors for doing evil.
Yeah, well, he's cautious with his words because he's making some fairly big claims there. And I was interested to see he said flu vaccines at the end there. So we're not even talking about mRNA vaccines. We're talking about vaccines in general, including flu vaccines. Well, I mean, I think COVID, you know my view, I think COVID itself is a bioweapon, which is exactly what the Russian military said when they
but
take...
I mean, isn't it a double whammy? So well, you catch a disease and then the so-called cure to it is also bad for you.
Ron Unns... An Unns review has collected together quite a lot of information about the possibility that it's a bioweapon. What he believes is that it was used by a rogue faction in the Trump administration to attack China, and then it spread all over the world. I actually think because of the timeline, and that the Israeli Defense Forces were told in November that there was a pandemic coming out of China, that there was a deliberate attack on China, and in September 2019 the banking system collapsed again, although we didn't know about that until the beginning of the spring. It wasn't just an attack on China,
it was an attack on humanity.
Yes, right. It's an attack on humanity, and why would the deep state in the West attack
humanity?
Well,
who is the deep state? I think Pfizer, one of these, I mean, you look at the amount of criminality in that company, the number of fines they paid. Yeah. You know, back in 2008, we had years of chatting about this, Martin, yeah. You and I, about the, this is a cost of doing business. So when they do something criminal, the banks, they think, well, we might have to pay a fine of X amount. Well, we're going to make X times 10. So let's do it,
it's not just profiteering and lack of concern for human welfare by pharmaceutical companies. Underlying all of this is a struggle for global power.
Well, that's true. Yeah, Pfizer are a big part of that. And Dr. Vernon Coleman, we've not heard from him on this show for a long time. He's still going strong, chugging out his videos, probably, I think, say, once a week now rather than every day that he was doing at the height of the pandemic. And he had this to say about Pfizer and other things.
Long before I was lied about in the media and on the internet and became a discredited conspiracy theorist, the BBC used to hire me as a presenter. I was breakfast TV doctor on TVAM, and the BBC made TV programmes based on my book Body Power. I made countless radio series for the BBC too. Now they're terrified, frightened to let me into a studio because they know I can convince people with facts that show that for 2.5 years the BBC has been telling lies and spreading misinformation. And as far as I know, they forgot to ask anyone else who knows why no one should accept the COVID jab to take part. Cowardice, perhaps? Maybe they didn't want to upset their financial partner, Bill Gates, Jeffrey Epstein's other little chum. If Epstein weren't dead, the BBC would give him his own chat show, maybe co-presenting with Jimmy Savile, or maybe something on children's television. But what's the betting they have Ms. Devi Sridhar on their new programme? She's the one who announced on the BBC, of course, that the COVID jab's 100% safe, apart from little niggly things like maybe your arm might be a bit sore. In January this year, she announced to the world that if all adults were vaccinated who were offered it, the pandemic would be over. She said that ICUs are full of people who chose not to get vaccinated, then regret it later. Is that fair to doctors and nurses, she said, and to those who need care for heart attacks and other life-threatening conditions, she added. If she did a little more research, she might find that hospitals were full of people who'd been vaccinated and regret it. The BBC, a financial partner of Bill Gates, did I mention the BBC is a financial partner of Bill Gates? The friend of Jeffrey Epstein, and Bill Gates being the man whose polio vaccine seems to be spreading polio around, never allows vaccine critics onto its programmes. The BBC policy is to keep the truth out of its programmes at all costs. Please, please, don't pay the licence fee. Do it legally, but don't give money to the BBC. It would be like giving poison to Dr. Crippen. Still, even now that I've been widely banned, my websites and videos still reach many millions, and that annoys them not a little. The truth is that lots of people are beginning to realise that all this is a load of rubbish. The PCR test is about as much use as sticking a piece of spaghetti up your nose. Thousands of employers realise that the test is utterly worthless and now expect their staff to keep on working even if they've tested positive. Every day, another celebrity is reported as being off sick because they've tested positive. No one needs to be off sick because they've tested positive. They're off sick because they've tested positive with a test, which is about as much use as a promise from Boris Johnson. The COVID jab is already being given to five-year-olds. In America, they're pumping the stuff into six-month-old babies, and they'll be doing that in the UK and everywhere else. Pfizer says it's safe, so that's okay. Even though I believe that Pfizer has for decades been one of the most dishonest, greedy and crooked companies in the world. How could I possibly say that if I didn't honestly believe it to be true? All Pfizer's executives and former executives should be locked up for 80 years to life. They must have known what sort of company it was. Did they not know, for example, that Pfizer was fined 84 and a bit million quid for overcharging the NHS by a mere 2,600%? Did they somehow miss the news that Pfizer was hit by a $2.3 billion fine for mispromoting medicines and paying kickbacks to doctors? Pfizer had a tranquilizer that it recommended to be used by children, with an illustration of a young girl with a tear-stained face and a suggestion that the drug could alleviate fears of, quote, school, the dark, separation, dental visits and monsters, close quotes. Am I the only person to wonder if Pfizer knew all the time that the COVID jab they were flogging was useless and dangerous? Glory be, huge profits and damehoods all round. Pfizer's been a nasty company for decades. Listen to this from my book The Medicine Men, which was published in 1975. Open quotes. In 1961, the British Minister of Health decided that Pfizer were charging too much for their tetracycline, and he took the unusual step of invoking the Patents Act and importing drugs from Italy. Close quotes. 60 years of greed and deceit. If you worked there, you'd know, wouldn't you? Even if you just polished the German shoes, you'd well know what sort of a company it was.
And if I was Director General of the BBC, Vernon Coleman would have his own show. He's extremely entertaining, and he knows his stuff, Martin, doesn't he, on doctors. It's interesting, isn't it, that he's picked up on this book from decades ago, the tricks that companies like Pfizer play on the public.
Yeah, but as I said earlier, Pfizer are not the only players in this game.
They're one of the major players.
But they are. I mean, but
if you, for example, if you go and have a look at Africa and their meningitis program in Africa, they were one of the first companies to go into Africa with a deliberate to do a mass experimentation on humans in Africa, hoping and thinking
and of course,
that they could use the part of their budget to bribe officials and possibly even to, you know, kill people who were stood in their way and tried to get any justice for those that were victims of the meningitis vaccine, which was damaged a hell of a lot of people and has destroyed and ruined lives in Africa. It's interesting because there is this racist aspect to this, this white supremacist aspect. Well, we can go and try it on a few black people in Africa, and then if anything goes wrong, we can just bribe them.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the basic theme of The Constant Gardener, the book and the film by John le Carré. And, you know, Pfizer, Borlaug, who's the CEO of Pfizer, he arranged that when they announced that they got the go-ahead to produce the COVID vaccine, that he cashed in his shares. He'd arranged it so that he would make millions by the cashing in of his shares with surrounding the announcement.
Well, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because he's not waiting until we find out whether it works or not. No. It's just all of the expectation on the back of that.
Yes.
He's then cashing his check in.
All of this is true, and they're embedded within particularly the US because of the privatised healthcare system they have in the US. That doesn't mean that vaccines that were developed for COVID in communist Cuba, and they had to develop their own because they weren't allowed to have any help from the West, are affected by the same problems, because they're not.
Well,
and of course, in Iran, they said the Iranian Revolutionary Guard said, we think the COVID attack is a biological warfare attack on us, and we don't want your vaccines. And of course, they're under sanctions anyway, so they wouldn't have got any. But they said, don't even think about sending this, because we think you've carried out a biological warfare attack on us with the virus. We're certainly not taking your vaccines. And of course, this is the people like Vernon Coleman are kind of, to my mind, halfway there. Vernon, the 9/11 attack was carried out by the deep state.
Well, that's not his area of expertise.
Exactly, but it's my
Martin.
Area of expertise. Well, and of course, don't judge
Vernon Coleman on your personal knowledge. He knows a hell of a lot more about how your body works than you do. And also, he's been on the case for decades.
Yes, but of course, he's missing the point about biological warfare. Biological warfare may be biological,
but it's also
warfare.
He didn't talk about biological warfare.
I'm the one who's talking about biological warfare.
You shouldn't have a go at somebody else who's doing the same sort of job from a different angle. I mean, what you're doing is you're able to contribute to what people like Vernon Coleman do rather than just condemning the guy
for
coming at things from a different...
I'm trying to engage.
It's a different expert angle. That's all.
Yes. But he's missing I would suggest that he's missing the point about what's behind all of this.
Yeah, but he would suggest
COVID itself is not just a flu. COVID itself is not just something
that
was made up.
He's not saying that, is he?
It'd be interesting to see what he does say about
that. Well, you can't just make up what you think he might say.
All right.
I'm sorry, we just heard a very interesting take on all of this, particularly with all the documented evidence about the history of the criminality of this
company. Yes, Pfizer shouldn't have been allowed anywhere near it.
That's what he's good at, and he did a fantastic job. Yeah. Anyway, we're going to go on now.
But it's not just about Pfizer, is it?
Called Yuval Noah Hariri. It's not. Of course it's not. Of course, nobody said it is. He didn't say it is just about Pfizer either, did he? Mm. Yuval Noah Hariri is this guy that was mentioned. If you were listening closely last week to rest in peace, Dr. Vladimir Zelenko, he is, you know, what I would call the sort of person who you could really, really listen to all day and all night. I love the guy, actually. Absolutely brilliant. Mostly because he's so genuine in his thoughts and his feelings and his explanations as to what goes on. The poison death jab, he just called it from the start. He called it right. And he just died a couple of weeks ago. But he mentioned this guy that he calls a prophet or false prophet, Yuval Noah Hariri. And he said, watch out for him. He's a bad guy. So let's have a listen to what the false prophet has got to say about where humanity is heading. He's a mate of Klaus Schwab's. And he's saying what Zev Zelenko said last week is that this is the guy who they all listen to. All these globalist elitist degenerates listen to. So let's have a listen to him. What is he telling them?
COVID is critical because this is what convinces people to accept, to legitimize total biometric surveillance. If we want to stop this epidemic, we need not just to monitor people, we need to monitor what's happening under their skin.
What we have seen so far, it's corporations and governments collecting data about where we go, who we meet, what movies we watch. The next phase is the surveillance going under our skin. We're now seeing mass surveillance systems established even in democratic countries, which previously rejected them. And we also see a change in the nature of surveillance. Previously, surveillance was mainly above the skin. Now it's going under the skin. Governments want to know not just where we go or who we meet. Above all, they want to know what is happening under our skin. What's our body temperature? What's our blood pressure? What is our medical condition?
Now humans are developing even bigger powers than ever before. We are really acquiring divine powers of creation and destruction. We are really upgrading humans into gods. We are acquiring, for instance, the power to re-engineer life. I know that in recent years, we saw populist politicians undermining deliberately the trust that people have in important institutions like universities, like respectable media outlets. These populist politicians told people that, say, scientists are this small elite, disconnected from the real people.
I mean, all this story about Jesus rising from the dead and being the Son of God, this is fake news.
Humans are now hackable animals. You know, the whole idea that humans have, you know, they have this soul or spirit and they have free will and nobody knows what's happening inside me. So whatever I choose, whether in the election or whether in the supermarket, this is my free will. That's over.
So that's Yuval Noah Hariri. Interesting, if he's a prophet, my God, you better watch out, folks. Thank you, God bless you, Zev Zelenko, for pointing out that this guy is the one they all listen to. So we can have a listen and see what kind of nonsense and brainwashed fascist appalling things that what is in the minds of the global elitist psychos, the globalists, the mega rich, the maniacs, the psychos, what's in their mind? Well, Yuval Noah Hariri is there to tell you and us, all of us. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also terrific artist and cancelled radical cartoonist. I mean that, actually. She really is. Have a look at her cartoons. Stella Perrett and sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. You can subscribe to my weekly email list at thisweekoneword.org.uk, and also you can find full-length interviews, story links. In fact, we've got a few this week, haven't we? Some of that, for example, that David Halpin interview is fascinating, full-length interview there. And also my paperbacks about the deals between the Allies and the Nazis during the war, the Bilderbergers and the Battle of Arnhem. That costs £15. That's a paperback, and that's called The Traitors of Arnhem. You can get it via www.bilderberg.org, or you can get an e-version or even a free version if you want to, at www.bilderberg.org. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRS stream, that is the talkradio.org.uk stream, except when we're restreaming the Richie Allen show, and also you can catch us over the weekend at Camberley's radioqeuk.com. do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioqeuk.com in Camberley, Surrey, our relay channel. Censorship and military disinformation is the norm in Britain today, thanks to the collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and we'll credit you here. I'll just take a little plug for Talking Pictures on Sunday evening, where they're rebroadcasting this series about Kessler, which is all to do with that Secret Army series, the brilliant series about the Second World War. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream on talkradio.org.uk at 5 o'clock next Friday. You notice we completely ignored the Tory leadership contest this week and all the farce there. God bless, and don't let the Illuminati banksters get you down.
Getting in tune, the music's played by the madman. Forever.